Or should I run after him? And say what? Where have you been? And why on earth are you denying all knowledge of me when together we committed a most hideous act?
Phoebe Price and Toby Jones star in Transcription by Kate Atkinson, starting on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds this afternoon at 3.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Sunday, the 19th of April. This is Charles Carroll. Good morning. Iran's parliamentary speaker says there's been progress in peace negotiations with the United States, but gaps remain. Mohammed Baghir Ghalibaf gave the update in a televised address last night. President Trump has told Iran it cannot use the Strait of Hormuz to blackmail the United States after Tehran closed the waterway again yesterday. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Nick Beek, has the latest.
Both the US and Iran continue to make uncompromising pronouncements. Mohammed Ghalibaf, who's Iran's chief negotiator, said their closure of the Strait of Hormuz would not end so long as the US naval blockade remained in place. But he also noted there were just one or two issues on which the two sides disagreed, without saying what they were nor explaining their significance. President Trump has remained supremely positive, in public at least, that an agreement will happen, announcing there had been very good conversations. But this was hours after a ship in the strait reported being fired on by Iranian gunboats. Mr. Trump said blackmail would not be tolerated. The ceasefire in Lebanon has eased the pressure in the Middle East a little and appears to still be holding. Israel said one of their soldiers was killed in the south of Lebanon with reports his vehicle hit a landmine. Separately, a French UN peacekeeper was also killed. The attack was blamed on Hezbollah, but the Iranian-backed group says it was not involved.
The Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, says Sir Keir Starmer would not have appointed Lord Mandelson as ambassador to the United States if he had known about the issues with his security vetting. The row about the appointment process has already seen Sir Ollie Robbins lose his job as the most senior civil servant at the Foreign Office. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
The Commons Foreign Affairs Committee will question Sir Ollie Robbins on Tuesday, perhaps to tee up a line of inquiry. The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has written to the committee's chair to say she's extremely concerned that ministers hadn't been previously told about Lord Mandelson's security vetting. In an interview with the Guardian newspaper, the Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, has said he had no doubt that had the Prime Minister known that Peter Mandelson hadn't passed the vetting, he would never, ever have appointed him. Writing in the Mail on Sunday, the Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch accused Sir Keir of letting others take the fall while he clings to power. But there doesn't seem to be at this stage a clamour from Labour MPs for the Prime Minister to follow Sir Ollie Robbins out the door.
Australia's most decorated living soldier has vowed to clear his name after being charged with war crimes in Afghanistan. Ben Robert Smith, who was awarded the Victoria Cross, has been accused of 5 counts of murder between 2009 and 2012. In his first public comments since being released from custody on bail, he said he categorically denied the allegations against him. He said that while in Afghanistan, he had always acted within the rules of engagement. The Metropolitan Police is stepping up patrols in an area of North London where there have been a series of attacks on the Jewish community. Scotland Yard said counter-terrorism officers, as well as uniformed and plainclothes police, would be on the streets to provide reassurance. Tom Simons reports.
The ramping up of policing includes extra armed response patrols, teams trained to intercept suspects using cars and motorbikes, as well as plainclothes officers specialising in counter-terrorism operations. Extra stop and search powers have been introduced across the London borough of Barnet to deter attacks and detect potential offenders. In the most recent incident on Friday evening, a man was seen setting light to a bag containing bottles of fluid outside the former head office of the educational charity Jewish Futures. Damage to the building was superficial, but it is being treated as an anti-Semitic hate crime. There have also been attempted arson attacks on a Persian language media organisation and a synagogue. In the most serious incident last month, ambulances belonging to a Jewish charity were set alight in Golders Green.
A charity is being established to honour Queen Elizabeth II and her lifelong commitment to public service. The formal launch will take place on Tuesday, the centenary of her birth. The Queen Elizabeth Trust will focus on restoring areas at the heart of communities such as green spaces and underused buildings. The King will be its patron. And a robot has beaten the new world record for a half marathon set last month by the Ugandan runner Jacob Kiplimo. It was among more than 100 humanoid robots which took part in a race in Beijing. The winning machine shaved 7 minutes off the record, completing the course in 50 minutes and 26 seconds. At one point, though, it crashed into a railing and needed help to get up before finishing. BBC News.
How has history shaped classical music?
Of course, it often happens in history that changes in music come with changes in society.
From the birth of musical notation to the digital streaming revolution. Join me, Gillian Moore, and leading experts, including Michael Wood, for an epic journey through 1,000 years of classical music.
What a miracle it is that we can still listen to music from so long ago.
Key Changes, Radio 3's essential history of classical music. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 4. Good morning. We're in a remote and beautiful part of the Lake District in half an hour, visiting one of the government's first landscape recovery projects in On Your Farm. Before that, Heart and Soul. This week, John Laurenson talks to a Chinese pianist who learnt to play for skill and success, but later found, through music, a deeper sense of meaning and of God.
There is a mysterious link between music and religion. Think of monks chanting in their monasteries and the Muslim call to prayer, gospel singing in churches in Alabama, and Bach signing all the music he ever wrote, Soli Deo Gloria, to God alone the glory. And sometimes music is a revelation. We hear it, and somehow we know, or think we know, that he is there, and he is great. I'm John Laurenson. For this week's Heart and Soul, I've come to Rome to meet a Chinese pianist who found God through music.
I first felt something was missing when I was about 20 years old, around a year before I graduated from university. I had already finished most of my studies and I was thinking about what to do next. I kept asking myself, what's next, what kind of life I'm going to. So on the other side, everything looked fine. I was studying music, I had a course, but inside I felt lost. It wasn't only about my career, it felt like I was missing someone or something to guide me.
Was there a moment when music stopped being enough?
Yes, I think so. There were moments like that. It was hard for me to admit, because music had always been my language, but sometimes when I couldn't find deeper meaning in what I was doing, when music felt like only technique or performance, I felt empty. For me, the music could express longing, but it couldn't answer it. That's when I realized my question about life were bigger than that music itself.
I'm 32 years old. I'm a pianist and live in Roma, Italy. My name is Irei. In Italy, I would like the people call me Eleonora because it's like the new name for me is new life. I was born in Hangzhou. It's a city near Shanghai and grew up there.
Did religion have a part in your life when you were small, when you were growing up?
When I was a child, in the school and our family taught us it's like you need to be good child, good student, yeah. So you need to focus on the study.
Yeah.
And don't think the things that you couldn't touch, because yeah. It's not useful for them. They think it's not useful, so you need to focus on the daily life, what you do, and the grades you take, and if you practice enough the pianoforte, it's like this.
Teachers would actually say,
concentrate on your work, don't think about spiritual things?
Yes, it's exactly my mother.
Okay.
Because my mother is a physical teacher.
Physics?
Science.
Okay.
And she doesn't believe.
So your parents weren't religious at all?
No. My mother just goes to temples to pray for us. Yeah. But she always told me that you need to believe in yourself, not at something else.
Tell me about your discovery of the piano. Were you very young when you started?
Yes. It's like I was 4 years old. That because both of my parents are a middle school teacher, so before they finish the work, they would leave me in the music classroom. There happened to be a piano here that which actually became my childhood toy and the company.
Oh.
It's like sad, like this.
So they didn't even invite you to play? You just saw a piano and started playing?
Yes, because the classroom is empty.
Oh.
There's only one piano.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. So it's like a big toy.
Do you remember what kind of pieces you were playing when you were a little girl?
Mozart, sonata. It's very, really easy for the child. Because I just like play the piano. I don't think it's like the homework. I just play.
Yeah.
I just enjoy.
Yeah. Could you explain the pleasure that you felt playing when you were small? Perhaps it's the same now. I don't know. But
okay, it's quite like you talk with someone with the music, because music for me is like a language. I could speak with my mouth. I could speak even with my finger. So that time I read the score, I play, it's like I have a community with the composer.
Was that especially important for you, do you think? Were you a quiet child?
Yes, it's very quiet. I like stay alone. I'm very shy.
Okay.
When I was a child, yes.
I wouldn't guess now, but okay.
No, yeah. A little bit better.
A little bit less.
Looking back, she thinks the search began long before she knew it, in the quiet child who found a way to speak through music.
I think for many children and teenagers, you know, discovering music, a particular kind of music, they adopt it as their own and it becomes part of their identity. It's kind of like a religious conversion somewhere. Did you experience something like that when you discovered music?
I say in Chinese. 其实在一开始的时候，最初我开始学习钢琴的时候， When I was a child, the feeling was not that so strong because I was constantly struggling with technique. But as I have grown older, especially at this age of my life, I often feel a sense of freedom and purity.
These are words that you can associate with the religious experience. When you look back at your childhood self, do you see a desire for God that perhaps you didn't recognize at the time?
I have always had a sense of curiosity and longing for a creator. I deeply believe that such a being exists because there are so many things that feel so perfect, such as laws of nature, human intelligence, and the harmony of music. I also believe that there is a presence watching over me, protecting me, accompanying me in planning my life, and help me in the search for the meaning of life.
I'm John Lawrenson. For this week's Heart and Soul, I'm in Rome with Eleonora Wang, the Chinese pianist who found God in music.
It was here in Italy that that curiosity about God started to become perhaps more conscious for you, and a curiosity about Christianity as well. How did that begin?
对，因为 Italy is full of churches, and once when I passed by a church, I noticed that in the quiet church there were people sitting there without speaking, and I felt curious about their behavior. Many works of art are connected to stories from the Bible. In order to understand those things, I wanted to study Bible stories in a systematic way.
So you had lots of questions about Christianity. Do you remember what those questions were?
Yes, it's like, was Jesus human or divine? If he was human, why did he rise from the dead? If he was a son of God, why was he betrayed and made to suffer? Who is Virgin Mary? What is the meaning of the cross?
In your second year at the Milan Conservatory, you took a sacred music course. Did you already feel something for sacred music at that time?
At that time, I only felt that sacred music carried an inexplicable sense of holiness, as if time suddenly stood still. It was a feeling I had never experienced before.
Sing and play together?
Yeah, if you can.
I try.
One day in this course, you encountered Vivaldi's Gloria. This was an epiphany for you. Tell us about that.
The opening of this work is very splendid and full of light, but when it reaches the Agnus Dei, it takes a sorrowful tone, especially at Qui tollis peccata muti. I felt a sense of nakedness, as if being exposed in broad daylight. I was immediately drawn in. Who is the Son of Father? Why is he called the Lamb of God? Why is he able to take away the sins of the world? At that time, I was completely unable to understand the meaning. So I began to search for answers. You could say that this moment inspired me to begin my journey of faith.
We wander down towards the church at the end of her road. Eleonora lives really close to the Vatican. You can actually see the walls of the city-state from where the Pope leads the Catholic world if you lean out of her window. She could then, if she wanted, go to Sunday Mass at St. Peter's, but she goes to this other local church. We sit in a pew at the back. What's it called, this church?
Santa Maria delle Grazie.
Saint Mary of Grace.
Yes.
It's a huge church, enormous, isn't it? Really big.
Yes. For me, it's very new.
Yeah.
Bright.
Yeah. What's the Mass like that you go to on Sunday?
I usually went to the Mass at 10 a.m. or 11 a.m. because it's full of children and teenagers.
And you like that?
Yes, it's very active.
Is the church full?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
From 7 a.m. to 12 a.m., every hour is full.
What's the prayer that you like the most?
Holy Mary.
Oh, yeah. Can you pray it for me? In Italian, you usually pray
Italian.
It. Yeah. Go on.
Okay. Ave Maria, piena di grazia, Signore con te. Tu sei benedetta fra le donne, e benedetto il frutto del tuo seno, Gesù. Santa Maria, Madre di Dio, prega per noi peccatori, adesso nell'ora della nostra morte. Madre nostra, prega per Gio, e per me e per tutti. Amen.
Amen.
Where do you usually sit? At the front?
Yes. Because I like to see the priest like a dog.
Yes. It's easier to understand when you see him speaking. I ask her about China, where she returns quite often. It's a delicate subject, Catholicism in China, because religion in general is strictly controlled. There is an unofficial church, but it has to operate clandestinely. On these political issues, Eleonora would rather not comment, but she will speak about her church life when she's there, which is as rich as the one she lives here. In her hometown, she's in a local Catholic youth group on WhatsApp that has 400 members. When you go back to China, you go to church in your hometown?
Yeah, in my hometown, even other cities. Oh. Every city I went, the first thing is search for the church.
Yeah. How does it compare, Mass here, Mass there?
It's a little bit different. Oh. The Mass here, I feel more peaceful.
Mm.
But in China, another feeling, I feel more like home, maybe because they speak my languages.
Yeah.
I could understand more, I can hear, I can feel the people.
Mm.
But now it's like prayer alone.
Mm. Mm. It's like you're praying alone?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
More silence for me.
Oh, okay. So it's more meditative?
Yes, because the Italian language for me is like, it sounds like music. So here it's like more like meditation, prayer. But in China it's like I can hear my language, so it's like they communicate with me.
Ah. So you like them both, in fact?
Yes, different feeling.
Yeah. Back home, Eleonora picks up her story again. In Milan's Chinatown, she found someone who could answer all the questions thrown up by Vivaldi and walking past churches. A Chinese priest named Father Zhao.
I remember the first time we met in the church and his office. He asked me, why you come here? I said, I want to know a little bit about who is Jesus. Mm. And who is God and the story of Bible. And then he asked me the first question. It's very, very interesting. He asked me, so you believe in something? Yeah. I answered, yes. Yeah. I believe in something, but I don't know who is it.
You've found your way to this priest thanks to the music.
Yes.
Do you think the people can hear God in music?
Yes, absolutely. I explain in Chinese.
Yeah.
I believe that through music, people can feel a kind of supernatural peace and the presence of beauty. This, for me, is a presence of God.
Why do you think that so many people are touched by the presence of God through music?
Because in the music, you no longer feel the passage of time or space. Often the moment when you are moved by beauty is a symbol of eternity. Many people were touched by this feeling because it is kind of beauty that no language or image can fully describe.
So Rossini?
Yes, it's all the concerts.
Oh, Rossini, okay.
In Rossini.
Sulla testa, in quest'abito, in quest'abito di braio. Se mi parla sposa onesta, dai matar esser non voglio.
She came to Italy because of Italian opera. And when she'd completed her studies at the conservatory, she began playing professionally, like at this concert in Milan that she shows me on her telephone.
Before that concert, I did Ave Maria.
Yeah.
Like, pray for me this concert. Very beautiful. I remember this.
And so you prayed just before, and did you feel her presence? Did you feel her help during the concert?
I hear the presence because I remember and in my prayer,
yeah.
I said, this concert, I want to play for you.
Oh, and did it change something?
Yes, I'm not nervous. I was
really?
Not nervous, yes.
Oh. You don't look nervous, actually, in the video.
Mm. Yes. It's like 1 hour concert, but I was not nervous.
Mm. It's interesting because you said that you're quite a timid person, quite a shy person.
Mm.
And for a shy person to get up on stage in front of all of these people,
mm.
it must be quite terrifying usually.
Yeah.
But you feel your faith has helped you with that, and overcome your fear?
It helped me a lot.
Yeah.
Helped me overcome my troubles.
Yeah, yeah. And more generally, even outside of the music, you feel it's helps you overcome fear?
Yes, yes. Especially when I feel weakness.
Mm.
Maybe when I made some troubles.
Mm.
I felt not lonely.
Oh.
Because I feel there's someone, there's God and Jesus. They always stay with me.
Yeah.
And they want to help me. So I just need to wait.
Getting back to the journey of faith that you started with Father Zhao,
yes.
did that change the way you saw things?
是的。 I was very surprised. First of all, it takes great courage to forgive and even to love one's enemies. It calls for complete self-giving and selfless help to others. It even rises to philosophical questions. How to transfer suffering into redemption?
And redemption, making yourself better again, being saved. Were the teachings of Jesus very different from the values that you were raised with?
是的，非常的不同。 Very different. The Beatitudes of Jesus completely overturn the worldly definition of success, happiness, and power. It is not the strong, the rich, or the winner who are blessed, but the humble, the suffering, the gentle, and those who hunger for justice, who can become truly human in God. This radically overturned the values I was raised with, which taught me that I had to become stronger and bigger in order to survive and avoid being hurt.
Did you start to pray at that time?
At that time, I didn't really know how to pray, so I asked Father Zhao how to do it. He taught me, just talk to God, share your thoughts and feelings with Him. This is prayer.
Do you think your faith has changed the way you play?
It has allowed me to focus not only on technical improvement, but more on experiencing the music itself and on seeing myself as an instrument through which the mystery and beauty of music can be communicated to others. Many times while playing, I no longer think about showing off, avoiding mistakes, or proving my ability to others. Only when you see yourself as a messenger can you truly bring the beauty and the motion of music to people.
How do people in China react to your faith, your family, for example?
Oh, when my family and friends in China first found out, they were surprised about my story, and they were curious. It wasn't something they expected from me, but after I shared my whole journey with them, my confusion, my searching, and how I felt loved and accepted, they were deeply touched. In the end, they were all happy for me.
While we're talking, a student of Eleonora's comes round. Eleonora is, as she says, a little shy, but here she's in her element and quite assertive. The voice of the student, Yuxin Rong, she's called, a future star by the sound of it, is so powerful I actually have to move out of the sitting room into the entrance hall. The neighbours must be loving it. Baptized in Milan in 2023, what was that experience like?
I always felt a deep longing to receive the Eucharist like everyone else, like a child. I longed and waited to truly enter this big family.
What changed in you the day after your baptism?
The day after, I woke up feeling very grateful. I felt accepted, I felt loved. Not because I had achieved something, but because I had been welcomed, I felt. The only word I can use is grace, something given, not earned. From that moment on, I never felt alone anymore. Whatever I did, I felt there was a quiet presence with me.
What's your religious and prayer life like now in Rome?
I try to integrate prayer into my daily life. Prayer is not only the moment spent kneeling in church, but something that can run through the entire day. Turn your work into prayer and your prayer into work.
Do you ever doubt now?
Yes, of course. I think doubt is very human. When you feel weak or when you face problems you can't control, you naturally ask why? Why this happened to me? But I don't see doubt as the opposite of faith anymore. I see it as part of my faith. Doubt doesn't destroy belief. It helps you think more deeply about it. It makes you understand what you really believe and why. In that way, doubt actually helps you to grow your faith.
Eleonora tells me she believes that the very existence of music is a testimony to the existence of God. He's the only plausible reason it exists. Why certain combinations of notes are so powerful, so beautiful. And she says, it brings us the peace and joy he wants for us. It is, she says, his gift.
Heart and Soul was presented by John Lawrenson. The producer is Rajiv Gupta. A new series exploring changing attitudes to death starts tomorrow here on Radio 4.
I'm Matthew Bannister, and I've been presenting Radio 4's obituary programme Last Word for 20 years. During that time, I've noticed big changes in the way we approach death and how we're remembered. In Doing Death Differently, I'll be chronicling those changes by attending a bespoke funeral infused with nature, taking you on the procession to the Liverpool Pyramid of the Dead, going behind the scenes at the only licensed water cremation facility in Europe, and thanks to AI, having a conversation from beyond the grave. Last Word, doing death differently, this Monday to Friday at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
With the Vatican at odds with the White House, Sunday in 35 minutes we'll be discussing the row between Pope Leo and President Trump with a journalist on the papal visit to South Africa. They'll be looking at the rise of Buddhist extremism and talking to some of the 5 million Christians in the Gulf about how they're coping with the new political landscape of the Middle East. That's after the news at 7. Before that, it's On Your Farm with Kaz Graham.
Come on, just let them chickens out. They're coming out for the day. 20 hens, a couple of cockerels, a couple of ducks. The ducks, they'll fly down to the river soon. I'll leave them be a bit now and come collect some eggs later on in the morning.
I'm in the remote southwest of the Lake District today with Paddy Deedy, who farms here at Troutle Farm in the Upper Duddon Valley. We've got fells rising up on either side of us into a really dreak and drizzly sky. And for a bit of geography, we're just to the west of the Old Man of Coniston, but it's much quieter over on this side of the Coniston Fells. Far less traffic and far fewer visitors.
Fairly traditional fell farm. We've got a stock of Herdwick sheep, which live most of the year on the fell, and we've got a small suckler herd, so we've only got 10 cows. They're inside at the moment. These are the calves. We're quite late calving.
Yeah, and what breed are these?
They're mostly Herefords crossed with a bit of Shorthorn.
Yeah, very bonny.
Very bonny, very quiet, good calves, yeah.
Tell me a bit about this farm. You're a tenant, aren't you, National Trust?
Yeah, it's a National Trust farm. I've had the farm, I'm in the seventh year now. It's very typical. So you see a lot of crags here, a lot of bracken beds, but it's very beautiful and that's part of its charm, the crags going through, being a climber as well. It's nice to remind you of your past.
Being a climber, very handy if you get a stuck sheep, I guess.
Yeah, that's one of my jobs as well, sheep rescue.
Yeah, the fells are just so integral to everything that you do here. You are a fell farmer and there's an enormous cultural history or tradition of farming these fells. I mean, people have made their living from this land for centuries, haven't they?
Yeah, a lot of the like farming calendar, traditional fell farming culture, it hasn't changed a great deal in the last few hundred years, I wouldn't have thought. Gathering sheep off the fells is one of the great jobs when it's going well. At the moment, my dogs aren't the greatest, but when your dogs are working well, it's a beautiful day. It's a sensational job to be doing. Yeah. Going to muck the cows out now and bed them, give them some hay.
So a long, long history to fell farming in this valley. But the way that Paddy and others here farm is changing, because they're now partners in a really pioneering piece of work called the Upper Duddon Landscape Recovery Project. Its aims, in a nutshell, are to help nature recover, deliver environmental outcomes like storing carbon and reducing flooding, while still preserving this fell farming culture and heritage over an extended period. It's one of just three of these whole landscape scale environmental land management schemes to have the official thumbs up and, importantly, funding from the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. It's a massive project and it's being led by the University of Leeds. Professor Dom Spracken from the university is here with us. Dom, just explain the idea behind these landscape recovery projects.
So when we left the EU, the government had to redesign the agricultural support schemes, and landscape recovery is one of the things that came out of that. It's the top tier for most ambitious nature recovery within those schemes. And I think it's a really great thing. There are lots of reasons for that. It's long-term schemes, so it's 20 years, at least 20 years, 20-plus years. And that gives farms financial security, but it also gives nature time to recover. You know, it takes that time for nature to come back. It's also really important because it's for big areas, so landscape recovery projects have to be at least 500 hectares in size. So for most places in England, that means multiple farmers coming together, because most farms are smaller than that. And in previous schemes, individual farms would do one thing in one field, one thing in another. And that was maybe great for nature, it did some good things. But to really help nature recover, we need to do things in a bigger and more joined up fashion. And that's what landscape recovery really allows us to do.
And the thing that really hits you when you come into this part of the world is the scale of the landscape. Huge hills, really fast flowing rivers that are scouring through the landscape. It's really, really impressive. Just give me an idea of how big an area the Upper Duddon is and what kind of a landscape we're looking at here.
It's 2,800 hectares in size, to kind of put that in perspective, it runs from the right at the top of the valley, from Rhino's Pass and Hardknott Pass, almost to the pub at Seathwaite, a distance of about 10 miles, really. So a massive area, pretty much the whole watershed of the River Duddon. Now, it's an amazing Lake District landscape of fells, of forests. So the fells are right up to the top, at 800 metres at the top of the fell. Amazing, beautiful, ancient oak woodlands at the bottom of the valley. A big forestry plantation in the centre, which the project will help restore over time. And that amazing fell vegetation as well.
Yeah, this project has got the word recovery in its title. What is this landscape? What are these fells and this river, the Duddon? It's just down at the bottom of the field there. What are they recovering from, and how are you going about that?
So I think in the past, agricultural policies have pushed farmers to farm these landscapes maybe a little bit too hard. So in some cases, some of the peatlands have been drained, a lot of the rivers have been straightened, and in some places, maybe too many sheep were out on the fell, and that's led to a bit of overgrazing in some places. And so what this project allows is maybe to farm in a slightly different way, in a slightly more gentle way maybe, that allows that nature to recover, but still in a way that respects that fell farming culture and traditions, and in a way that will be very recognisable to people as fell farming still, but in a way that can do farming and nature at the same time.
And the way that you can do all that at the same time is because you work as a partnership, and partnership is really important to this whole thing. What is the partnership you have here, and who is in it?
Yeah, so it's a collaboration between all of the farmers at the top of the valley. That's really crucial and really integral. But it's a complex scheme, and that's where University of Leeds comes in, because we can help administer and manage and help design the scheme. And then we've got a range of other partners as well. National Trust and Forest England are the two major landowners in the valley, so they're really crucial to the whole scheme. South Cumbria Rivers Trust, who are helping a lot of the river restoration and peatland restoration, and University of Cumbria as well.
And I guess the thing about a partnership is that it means that there isn't one big body that's coming in and imposing a sort of top-down, one-size-fits-all system on these farmers in this valley. Is that right?
Exactly. And Landscape Recovery has this two-year development phase where we sat down and had a lot of meetings, we had a lot of walking out on the fell to work out what was going to work for the farmers in this valley to allow nature to recover, but also in a way that works for their farm business at the same time.
Right, well, Paddy has just about finished with mucking his cows out. We're going to join him again, along also with Mark Hodgson, who farms, what, just up, down, up the valley from here, Mark?
Yeah, up the valley at Blackhall Farm.
Paddy, the idea of these environmental land management schemes is that you get paid public money for delivering public goods. I mean, how does that work out practically? Do farmers here get a specific payment for doing a specific action?
Landscape Recovery relies on real ambition in terms of doing that work for the environment alongside your farming. So we've all made our individual farm plans for how we want to farm, how much we want to do towards those environmental gains that the project is trying to make. We get paid in accordance to the ambition of our farm and our project.
And what's that meant for you, Mark? What are you doing on your farm?
Well, we took the farm over last September and we weren't in any scheme. And like, we were working off farm 7 days a week to just try and pay for the farm. Whereas now the scheme started, we can then jumpstart straight into the environmental stuff that we want to do.
In terms of the way that you're farming the land here, I mean, traditionally these would have big flocks of sheep on them. Have you reduced the kind of numbers of sheep that are on these fells?
Yeah, well, at Blackhall, we're 1,000 hectares of freehold fells. It will have been running about 1,400 on the fell, and we're down to 550 now. But it's more manageable. We're going to make a big difference to the fells. And it's three different flocks, which is a challenge within itself. But without this scheme, in that first year we were at the farm with no payments, we didn't know if we were going to make it to the next year, because you're working off farm, you're spending no time at home, you're not achieving anything. And if you are, you're working at 9, 10 o'clock at night. Whereas now, with the scheme and the money, I've employed someone full-time and someone part-time to help achieve these goals that we've got in our heads. So.
And what are the other farmers that you know around here, ones who aren't in this project, make of it? I mean, you know, they're looking over the wall going, oh, it's quite an interesting idea.
Yeah, well, there's been a lot of mixed opinions, I think, over the last few years. But since the scheme started and they're starting to see what we're actually doing, we're not just wanting to plant loads of trees and take all the sheep off. I think we are definitely showing people what you can do through environment and still farm at the same time. So it comes down to figures, and you have to make sure everything's viable. Like, I'm only 29, it's going to be my future now for hopefully the next 20 plus years.
Right, well, we've dragged you away from your future this morning, because I know you have got a stack of work waiting to do back on the farm at home. Thanks so much for coming down and joining us. Dom and Paddy, I know you're going to be kind enough to give me a sort of guided tour of the work that you've been doing here in this project. And we have got a bit of walking to do, I believe.
Yeah, you're going to need your wellies. It's wet underfoot. And we're going to walk up there to see some tree planting, I think.
Right, wellies, waterproofs, the lot. We'll leave these cattle in their nice, warm barn.
Very good, yeah.
It's quite steep, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a tough place to get to. There's no road access here, so the walk-in we're doing is the quickest way in, really.
You don't get your Tesco delivery.
Yeah, certainly don't. Other supermarkets are available. Oh.
And the mist is
Look
lifting.
At that. The Look mist that. Is just lifting.
It's amazing. You can see over to the side of the fell now.
Stickle, it's called that. This is Core, just coming into view, pyramidal shape.
Yeah, you say just coming to the view, and it's still got the cloud right on the top of it, just kind of sitting on it, but it looks like it's going to go quite soon, although I have to say that the rain is still driving into our faces, isn't it?
Yeah, but everything's waking up. There's a buzzard coming up the valley here, I think.
We're just tramping through a load of bracken down really quite a steep bank. And hooray, we can see the tree planters down there.
There they are. Yeah, so we're into this bit of bracken. It's a good sign that woodlands would have once been here, so a perfect place for us to be planting some trees and sort of extending the woodlands up the slope a little bit.
Well, now we've got down into this bit of clearer ground. There's a whole team of people out planting here. Lots of work going on. Jess Wilson is one of them, and she's not only a dab hand at wielding a shovel, she is also an ecologist, a computer mapping specialist, and one of the Upper Duddon's project managers. Jess, what are you planting?
So we're planting a range of broadleaf species today. Rowan, hazel, oak and downy birch.
And while you are just clearing this bit of ground, just tell me, what are the benefits of planting this kind of native woodland?
The main thing is biodiversity. So native species support such a wide range of different types of biodiversity, from invertebrates, which support bird life, and then mammals as well. So it's just part of a whole ecosystem, basically. Obviously, there's benefits for carbon storage, climate change. There's no end to the benefits.
And what kind of scale of planting are you doing across the whole project, across the Upper Duddon?
So we're doing mostly wood pasture planting. So that's kind of more spaced out, with the idea of kind of having bigger open-grown trees. Wood pasture is basically where you can combine tree planting, so more tree cover, but keep farming as well as alongside it. So it's cattle grazed land with open grown trees. It's a bit of a best of both worlds, essentially. You get better sward, better diversity in the vegetation from the cattle. You also get tree cover, so we're increasing that kind of tree canopy across a wider area, but without any sort of dense woodland block planting.
And there's a big history of commercial forestry in the area of this project too, isn't there?
There is, yeah. So historically, Hardknot Forest has been a commercial forest. So it was planted up with Sitka spruce, so sort of wall-to-wall conifer plantation, very straight rows, sort of very uniform planting. So quite different to what we want it to look like, which is going to obviously be much more natural, much more spaced out planting.
So what's happening with that forest then?
So that forest is going to be converted from the conifer plantation. It'll be converted into broadleaf native woodland. So as the conifer comes out, native broadleaf is regenerating in that space naturally.
And some of that commercial forestry, I mean, you're actually using some of that wood in this project, aren't you?
We are, yeah. It's one of the best things about the project, I think, is that we're managing to utilise the diseased larch, so it has to come out anyway. It's not really worth a huge amount of money commercially, but we do need material in the valley to do capital works projects, so fencing, leaky dams, boardwalks, all of that kind of stuff. So the fact that we have that material on site, we can process it on site, and quite often these fence posts are moving no more than a mile, a much lower impact as well.
As a project manager, I guess there's more to your job than just planting trees on a wet hillside. I mean, what else are you involved in? What else do you do?
So a lot of it's probably kind of coordinating things with the farmers as well. So we do work quite closely with our farmers. So that's kind of checking in with them, making sure that they're happy with everything that's going and that they know sort of what they need to do to keep up with targets and that sort of thing. So there's just a lot of communication, I think, really, just making sure that all of the partners and the farmers, the landholders, everybody
it's kind of all on the same page. Right, well, I've stopped you digging, so you better get on with planting this tree. Ishbael Hayes, who is part of the team here, is planting as well. You have got a filthy face, can I just say that?
Yeah, I've got mud all over my face. I always end up that way.
Everyone's got mud all over them. I mean, it's a mucky old
it's
job,
one of
isn't
those
it?
Days, yeah.
And you're quite new to the project, aren't you?
Yeah, I just started in January. I'm the monitoring officer for the project, so I'll be doing a lot of the habitat monitoring, which is one of the major ways we're going to sort of measure the success of the project, whether the habitats are improving condition over time and where we're creating new habitats or changing the habitats, whether they're coming along as we expect them to as well.
Well, one of the benefits of planting up new native woodland like we've just seen is that it's an ideal habitat for wildlife. And I have just come into a piece of really mature native woodland to meet John Hinks, who is doing some wildlife monitoring right now. I don't know why I'm speaking quietly, because actually the wildlife we're looking for would have been and gone. Tell me what you've got down here.
Hi.
Attached to this tree, John.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, this is a trail camera, which we've got set up at the base of this silver birch, and it's positioned in a way it's pointing at what we describe it as a tea sniffer. It's basically like your plastic plumbing. Got the pipe sticking in the ground, another bit of pipe a couple of foot off the ground, and on there we put bait to attract pine martins.
What is a pine martin? What just remind us what they look like.
They're mustelids, so it's the same family as badgers, stoats, weasels. They're a brown, sort of chocolatey brown colour, and have this lovely cream bib on the bottom and dark patches to the top of their ears.
Oh, right. So, look, let's look at the bait on the other side of it. Right, so there is still bait.
There's a bit there still.
Stuck on there. What is that?
That's what's left over, some peanut butter. We've got a real sweet tooth. Peanut butter, jam, peanuts, raisins, sometimes a bit of honey. The way the pipe's set up is that the martin will stand up to reach the bait, and that gives us a shot of its bib, which is like the dorsal fin of a dolphin or our fingerprints. It uniquely identifies each animal, so we can determine population densities and so on. So I'm just opening up the trail camera. We check these fortnightly. I'm just going to go to the bottom here and go through images. But we regularly have a pine martin.
They're still really rare, pine martins, aren't they?
Yeah, very rare. I mean, they always were present in the Lake District, persecuted to extinction in the 1800s and so on.
You've spent a lot of time in this valley through your lifetime, haven't you? What do you make of what's happening here now? And what do you think local people make of the changes that this landscape recovery project is bringing in?
Well, I think it's an absolutely fantastic thing. It's enhancing nature. It's making sure there's a continuation of farming, upland farming and the hill farming culture, working hand in hand together. It's created employment. I mean, you've met the team today and obviously myself. So, yeah.
Job for local bloke.
Yeah. I think the local community, the environmental schemes can sometimes, people think, oh, here we go, this isn't going to be fought through, and, you know, they're going to be reintroducing things without thinking and covering all the fells with trees and removing all the sheep, and that's not what we're about at all. There's plenty of room for more trees. Anywhere we see bracken would have been trees. There's lots of consultation. We're about working with everyone, so the farms on our project site, it couldn't happen without them. They're very much partners, equal partners, and there's compromises on both sides. But I think when people say that we're enhancing nature and we're facilitating farming still, continuation of farming and local jobs, I think people come round to see that it's a positive.
John, really nice to meet you. Thanks ever so much for showing me how you attract pine martins with peanut butter and jam.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised they don't need major dental treatment. They do like their sugar.
There's been so much rain here recently. The water is just pouring off these hills. I've just caught up with Dom Spracken from the University of Leeds again. And Dom, we've only been able to touch on a few aspects of this landscape recovery project this morning, but it's a huge, ambitious and lengthy piece of work. Tell me, how much is it all costing? And who is paying for it all?
So it's a 20-year project. The full cost of the whole project is £34.5 million. Most of that funding comes from DEFRA, but a really important part of landscape recovery is that all projects need to find some private finance. And so the really crucial partner for us is United Utilities. They've got a waterworks down the valley that supplies communities in South Cumbria. And everything that we're doing as part of the project is helping improve that water quality and is reducing costs for United Utilities. So they're paying into the project to recognise that, and that's a crucial part of the private finance that is coming into our project.
Some people might say, £34 million, that money should be being spent elsewhere.
So that's over 20 years, but that's supporting 8 farms across this valley, and it's supporting up to 14 jobs in the valley. So it's a new jobs for young people living locally, and just bringing total new life to this valley. And, you know, I initially got involved in this project. It was all about the nature for me. But I think what's really exciting to me about the project is that these farms are secure, these new jobs, and the new life that's coming back into this valley is really amazing to see. Everyone's really excited.
OK, we're going down to that beautiful-looking farm down there. Is that right?
Yeah.
Hiya, Chris.
We've come to High Wallaborough Farm to meet Chris Chin, and we're in the yard now. Beautiful, beautiful old buildings you've got here.
The farmhouse here is 1750, around that time, and what we call the old house here, which is now a camping barn, is probably 100 years older. I've been here this time since 2003. I also lived here as a teenager and in my 20s, and we're lucky enough to get the tenancy here 23 years ago.
What does it mean to you to be part of this Upper Duddon project?
It's incredibly important. It secures our future here on the farm. I've raised 3 kids here who are now in their 20s, and they've all put in a lot of love and effort into the place. And that's really key on these small places in the uplands. This farm has always been borderline in terms of viability. I've a son who's interested in being on the farm full-time. He's very committed, very hard-working, but there was always an issue in finding his wages from the business. Even though we've diversified years ago into accommodation and doing other things. So this really is guaranteeing 20 years of payments that will contribute towards his livelihood here if he decides to stay here, and the National Trust want to offer him a tenancy beyond my days. It's been fantastic working with my kids on this place, knowing that we're working towards encouraging species that have been extinct in this area to return, to get the biodiversity back in balance, and to be contributing to society and the environment in a wider sense.
Christian, thanks so much for showing me just a little of your farm. And thanks so much also to Dom Spracken, who's still with us here from the University of Leeds, for showing me the Upper Duddon Valley and also all of this landscape recovery work that's taking place here.
On Your Farm was presented and produced by Kaz Graham. It's a BBC Audio Bristol production. Farming Today next week is focused on the drive to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture, starting tomorrow with a call for global farming to end its dependence on fertiliser made from fossil fuels. That's tomorrow morning and all next week at 6:15 on Radio 4 and on BBC Sounds. Time for a look at the weather now. Here's Elizabeth Riccini.
Thank you, Richard. Good morning. Not a lot of rain to come in the forecast for the next week, with high pressure very much in charge. But there will be a few showers around at times. It's a chilly start to this morning, but a very pleasant Sunday ahead. We've seen a touch of frost out there, with also some patches of mist and fog, notably across Western Wales and Southwest England. But lots of sunshine around this morning. However, for Scotland and Northern Ireland, there will be a lot more cloud developing, and that will tend to spread out underneath the area of high pressure. It's going to limit the sunshine and, of course, the temperatures. So feeling quite cool today underneath that cloud. And northwest Scotland could also see some showers on and off throughout the day. For Northern Ireland, again, more isolated showers. For many here, it will be completely dry, but just quite a bit more cloud developing. Let's move further south towards England and Wales. The mist and the fog, where we see it, it's not everywhere, will be lifting and clearing lots of sunshine here, with more fair weather cloud developing through the afternoon, decently long spells of sunshine. It's a very pleasant day of weather with light winds and just the small chance of one or two showers popping up for Lincolnshire, for the North Midlands and for parts of East Anglia. But I think you'll be unlucky to catch those showers. Temperatures were 12 to 15 Celsius in the south, maybe 16 in the far south. Southeast, 10 to 13 degrees Celsius further north. Now, tonight it's going to be another chilly one. For most of us, clear skies. For South Wales and for Northern and Eastern Scotland, there will be some low cloud developing, and also across parts of Scotland, particularly the far north and the east, then we're expecting some showery outbreaks of rain across the Northern Isles too. More cloud developing for eastern England as the wind turns a little bit more easterly, and underneath the cloud, then of course it will feel milder. But where we have the clear skies, and that's the case for many of us, a touch of localised frost, generally lows of 1 to 4 degrees Celsius. A few more showers tomorrow.
The most haunted house in England, or a Victorian ghost hunter's elaborate hoax? Witnesses to genuine poltergeist activity, or a 1960s Yorkshire family with an overactive imagination? Join me, Danny Robbins, and my team of paranormal experts as we dig deep into the past, reopening classic cases and searching for the truths they left behind. Secrets still remain. Uncanny Cold Cases. Listen on BBC Sounds.
On 92 to 95 FM on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
BBC News at 7 o'clock on Sunday, the 19th of April. Good morning, this is Charles Carroll. Iran has indicated some progress has been made in peace talks with the United States, but says many gaps remain. The Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, has said Sir Keir Starmer would never ever have appointed Lord Mandelson as US ambassador had he known about the outcome of the vetting process. And police patrols have been stepped up in northwest London after a series of attacks targeting the Jewish community. Iran's parliamentary speaker says there's been progress in peace negotiations with the United States, but gaps remain. Mohammad Baghir Ghalibaf gave the update in a televised address last night. President Trump has told Iran it cannot use the Strait of Hormuz to blackmail the United States after Tehran closed the waterway again yesterday. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is reporting from Tehran on condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service. These restrictions apply to all international media organisations operating in Iran.
The message from Mohammed Baghir Ghalibaf was clear. The Strait of Hormuz was under Iran's control. To prove his point, he spoke of an incident where Iranian forces had, in his words, firmly confronted a US minesweeper. It happened when he was in Islamabad last weekend for high-level talks with US officials. He had warned them that if the US ship moved from its position, it would be fired on. He said the US communicated that to its minesweeper within 15 minutes. Mr. Ghalibaf called the US naval blockade on Iran's ports a reckless and ignorant decision. President Trump has made it clear it won't be lifted until there's a deal between Tehran and Washington. Mr. Ghalibaf spoke of progress in the negotiations, but he said there were many gaps and some fundamental points, a starkly different assessment from Mr. Trump's upbeat account that a deal could be done in days.
The Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, says Sir Keir Starmer would not have appointed Lord Mandelson as ambassador to the United States if he had known about the issues with his security vetting. The row about the appointment process has already seen Sir Ollie Robbins lose his job as the most senior civil servant at the Foreign Office. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has written to the chair of the Cross-Party Foreign Affairs Committee. Its members will question Sir Ollie Robbins on Tuesday, perhaps to tee up a line of inquiry. In her letter, Ms. Cooper says she's extremely concerned that ministers hadn't been previously told about Lord Mandelson's security vetting. And in an interview with the Guardian newspaper, which broke the vetting story, the Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, has said he had no doubt that had the Prime Minister known that Peter Mandelson hadn't passed the vetting, he would never, ever have appointed him. But the announcement of Lord Mandelson's appointment was made before that security vetting had been completed. Writing in the Mail on Sunday, the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, accused Sir Keir of letting others take the fall while he clings to power. There doesn't seem at this stage to be a clamour from Labour MPs for the Prime Minister to follow Sir Ollie Robbins out the door, but the continuing controversy around the Mandelson appointment won't have improved his job security.
The Metropolitan Police is stepping up patrols in an area of North London where there have been a series of attacks on the Jewish community. Scotland Yard said counter-terrorism officers, as well as uniformed and plain-clothed police, would be on the streets to provide reassurance. Tom Simons reports.
The ramping up of policing includes extra armed response patrols, teams trained to intercept suspects using cars and motorbikes, as well as plainclothes officers specialising in counter-terrorism operations. Extra stop and search powers have been introduced across the London borough of Barnet to deter attacks and detect potential offenders. In the most recent incident on Friday evening, a man was seen setting light to a bag containing bottles of fluid outside the former head office of the educational charity Jewish Futures. Damage to the building was superficial, but it is being treated as an anti-Semitic hate crime. There have also been attempted arson attacks on a Persian language media organisation and a synagogue. In the most serious incident last month, ambulances belonging to a Jewish charity were set alight in Golders Green.
Australia's most decorated living soldier has vowed to clear his name after being charged with war crimes in Afghanistan. Ben Robert Smith, who's 47, served in the Special Forces and was awarded the Victoria Cross. He's been accused of involvement in five murders while taking place between 2009 and 2012. In his first public comment since being released from custody on bail, he told reporters he had never run from a fight in his life.
My family and I have been subject to a campaign to convince Australians that I've acted improperly in my service in Afghanistan. I categorically deny all of these allegations, and while I would have preferred these charges not be brought, I will be taking this opportunity to finally clear my name. I'm proud of my service in Afghanistan. While I was there, I always acted within my values, within my training, and within the rules of engagement.
Brazil, Mexico and Spain say that they will step up aid supplies to Cuba to alleviate what they've described as a humanitarian crisis caused by the US oil blockade on the island. The Cuban economy was already in trouble before the White House stopped oil exports in January. Since then, Cubans have been living with nationwide power cuts, while the UN has warned that hospitals are struggling to maintain services. Voting is underway in Bulgaria in the 8th parliamentary election in the country in 5 years. Nationwide protests against economic policies and corruption led to the collapse of the coalition government last December. Many of the demonstrators were young people. Our global affairs correspondent, Amber Hassan Etirajan, reports.
Bulgaria has been hit by a political crisis in which weak coalitions have failed to survive in recent years. Corruption, instability and poor governance have caused people to lose faith in democratic institutions. The leading contender to become the next prime minister is Rumen Radev, a pro-Russian former fighter pilot who stepped down as president in January. His victory could influence Bulgaria's foreign policy, with Mr. Radev willing to improve relations with Moscow. Analysts say his alliance, Progressive Bulgaria, may not get an outright majority and may need coalition partners which could help to soften his pro-Russian stance. The stakes are high in this election for Bulgaria domestically as well as in its role within Europe.
A charity is being established to honour Queen Elizabeth II and her lifelong commitment to public service. The formal launch will take place on Tuesday, the centenary of her birth. The Queen Elizabeth Trust will focus on restoring areas at the heart of communities, such as green spaces and underused buildings. The King will be its patron. Well, that's the news. Time now for a look at the Sunday newspapers. Time for Straight Talking is the Sunday People headline, as it leads on Iran's decision to close the Strait of Hormuz again because of a US blockade of its ports. The front of the Sunday Telegraph features a picture of a US Apache helicopter watching over tankers in the waterway. The paper quotes a Wall Street Journal report that the American military has drawn up plans to board and seize Iranian-linked ships in the coming days, in an attempt to force a reopening of the strait. Kemi Badenoch's comments about the Prime Minister's handling of the Lord Mandelson vetting row make the front page of the Mail on Sunday. Starmer's not fit to run the country is its headline. The Conservative leader writes that Sir Keir Starmer is taking the public for fools with his explanations about the vetting. A Labour source is quoted as saying no one is more lazy or unfit for office than Kemi Badenoch.
An explosive debate is what the Observer is expecting when the Prime Minister appears before the Commons tomorrow to give his account of the vetting row. The paper says that he will be up against political rivals looking to make hay ahead of next month's elections. The Sunday Times editorial says an unreserved apology is required from Sir Keir Starmer if he has any hope of drawing a line under this miserable affair. The Sun's leader suggests the vultures are circling around the PM already, a reference to the paper's story about what it calls a secret summit held by Angela Rayner and Andy Burnham on Friday night. The Sun says the bombshell revelation will fuel rumours that they're hatching a plot that could see Sir Keir face a leadership challenge within weeks. Allies of the pair insist they are simply friends who talk regularly. The composer, Lord Lloyd Webber, has told the Sunday Times that he is a recovering alcoholic. He says that he decided he needed help 16 months ago and has been attending Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in the UK and in Switzerland. The peer is quoted as saying his family were in a desperate state, with his wife reportedly feeling she couldn't go on. Going downhill, Liz, asks the Sunday Mirror as it covers a trip by the former Prime Minister Liz Truss to the Swiss ski resort of Davos. She is described by the Mirror as shameless because the event is about building bridges with the EU and Ms. Truss was an arch Brexiteer. Her spokesperson has declined to comment. The paper, though, suggests she is taking the piste. A look at some of Sunday's newspapers.
That was Charles Carroll. This is Radio 4. Sunday worship in an hour's time reflects on finding hope and resurrection in a wounded world. Now, though, it's Sunday with Emily Buchanan.
Welcome to Sunday. As you've heard in the news, the Strait of Hormuz is closed and Iran says it's far from a peace deal. We've an update on the war and we hear how Christians in the Gulf are coping with the conflict.
A door slams and people jump because they think it's an explosion. I found myself the other day listening to my kettle whining and I was looking out of the window to see if it was a drone coming past the window.
We hear the tales of Temple Church, one of London's oldest places of worship, as its reverent and valiant master gets ready to retire after 30 years in charge of this historic gem.
The interior diameter is exactly half the diameter of the sepulchre in Jerusalem. To the medieval mind, you are now in Jerusalem. You're at the centre of the world.
And the project giving Muslim women a tantalising taste of being a DJ as a first step to creative expression.
People say there's a lack of talent when it comes to people of colour in the arts, but I think it's just a lack of opportunity. So I want to try and bridge that with these workshops.
Do send your comments to sunday@bbc.co.uk. Alongside the negotiations between Washington and Tehran, we've had the unprecedented sight of an American president and an American pope seemingly engaged in their own war of words, although Pope Leo says he regrets his remarks being interpreted as a debate with President Trump. The story was fueled by an AI-generated image of Donald Trump in a Christ-like pose, followed by a stream of criticism from the president of the pope's views on the war.
Pope Leo said things that are wrong. He was very much against what I'm doing with regard to Iran, and you cannot have a nuclear Iran. Pope Leo would not be happy with the end result. You have hundreds of millions of people dead, and it's not going to happen. I think he's very weak on crime and other things, so I'm not. I mean, he went public. I'm just responding to Pope Leo.
I have no fear, neither the Trump administration nor speaking out loudly about the message of the gospel. I am called to do what the church is called to do. If we're not politicians, we're not looking to make foreign policy, as he calls it, with the same perspective that he might understand it. But I do believe that the message of the gospel, blessed are the peacemakers, is a message that the world needs to hear today.
That clip of Pope Leo was recorded as he headed off on a visit to Africa at the beginning of last week. Elise Ann Allen, who's written a biography of the Pope, has been travelling with the press on the papal plane and sent us this message from Angola.
I think the standout moments so far have honestly been, of course, his visit to the sites honouring St. Augustine in Algeria. He went to the archaeological site of Hippo and celebrated Mass at the Basilica of St. Augustine in Annaba in Algeria. That was quite a standout moment for him. He said that he really wanted to begin his papacy this way. But at the same time, I think his visit to Bamenda in Cameroon was quite the strongest moment so far. It's that is where he really came alive, became very passionate, and started using this very vivid language, and really he became much stronger in his tone, had this booming speech that he gave at a peace event in Bamenda. Of course, that line that has gone viral now about, you know, the world being ravaged by a handful of tyrants. And of course, this language that he has used in Bamenda and further calls to end conflict, condemning those who use God and faith to justify violence and war, and those who spend billions on the arms trade, for example. He said they look the other way and pretend not to know that it takes one day to destroy and really more than a generation to recover. So a lot of people have been interpreting these remarks, of course, as a response to U.S. President Donald Trump and Donald Trump's outburst against Pope Leo on Sunday before, you know, right as Leo was set to depart. Leo responded, of course, to those remarks. And he told us today on the flight over, you know, that the narrative that this is him versus Trump and that his remarks here in Africa are against Trump are wrong. He said that that is false, you know, that he is not intending everything he says to speak against Donald Trump. But these are really messages for Africa.
Elise Ann Allen. Another big moment of this standoff came midweek when Vice President J.D. Vance was asked what he made of the Pope's criticism of the war in Iran.
When the Pope says that God is never on the side of those who wield the sword, there is more than a thousand year tradition of just war theory. Okay. Now, we can, of course, have disagreements about whether this or that conflict is just, but I think that it's important, in the same way that it's important for the Vice President of the United States to be careful when I talk about matters of public policy, I think it's very, very important for the Pope to be careful when he talks about matters of theology.
For a theologian's perspective on this battle over theology, we turn to Anna Rowlands, professor at Durham University and a member of the Vatican Department concerned with social teaching. I asked her what she made of the Vice President's warning to Pope Leo.
It's a rather provocative and quite extraordinary statement if one is to take it at face value. And if one takes it at face value, then it at very least raises questions about the kind of individuals who perhaps are involved in J.D. Vance's own theological formation as a relatively young Catholic. So if one's reading it charitably, one could ask questions about where he's receiving his own catechesis from. If one reads it more politically, and I'm a little bit more inclined to read it in that way, I think what's interesting is it raises real questions about why J.D. Vance slightly misquotes Pope Leo. So in this instance, he talks about the Pope suggesting that God is not on the side of those who would be in situations of, for example, liberating France or liberating Auschwitz, and that seems absolutely incredible. But Pope Leo very carefully said, those who wage war. So this is a situation in which people are not acting in self-defense or as they were in the context of the Second World War as liberators, as part of a wider war that was justified as a just war situation for the Allies. He's struggling to take Pope Leo on his own terms. How would he reply to that? And I think actually we know that J.D. Vance himself doesn't seem to be particularly keen on the Iran conflict, and yet he's been left having to try and sort of negotiate out of the wreckage of it. So I wonder whether he himself is in a rather more difficult situation, but at the same time is perhaps himself playing Pope Leo rather politically.
And how do you see the reaction of Pope Leo? His statements are getting stronger and stronger, aren't they?
I think that Pope Leo has been incredibly careful so far not to personalise and not to polarise in his comments. So even when he was very critical around issues of interventions in other sovereign nations earlier in the year, when he's had concerns about immigration and so forth, he's tried to express this generally. He hasn't personalised it around Trump. And I think the turning point really was the comments around civilizational erasure. And I think at that point, he felt that absolutely morally he had to speak. Now, what's interesting is, and we should be clear about this, this isn't Pope Leo speaking out of simply an arcane religious tradition that doesn't really have a right to speak in a modern, perhaps secular age. He's actually speaking about the basis of international law. So you've got a Pope defending international law and the theological basis of that in just war theory that's part of the Christian heritage, taking on an American president who isn't speaking in the language of international law. So it's a rather interesting situation when it's the Pope who's the defender of that language. But I think he's absolutely clear in his own mind that he doesn't want to be drawn into a personal spat with Trump. And indeed, some of the comments that we've seen this week, for example, when he was talking about power in the hands of a small number of tyrants who are kind of waging war rather than bringing peace and well-being and education and healing to people. Those are speeches that would have been long crafted before any of this week's events. So these are addresses that he was due to give during his visit to Africa. And it happens that, you know, I suppose, and we see this with the scriptures generally, their message abides through the ages. And so it happens that those words turn out to be particularly prescient and powerful this week. But he didn't script those as a response to the spat of Trump's own making.
You know, many people wonder, too, if it's all a bit of a distraction. You know, he could easily be drawn in to this sort of personal confrontation.
Yes, and I think that Pope Leo would rather that you and I were not having this particular conversation right now. I think he would rather that we were talking about the impact of war on people in Lebanon, on those in Iran, on situations of conflict in Africa, where he's visiting this week as well. And I think that that's the conversation he wants to draw us back to. And he has, from the moment that he appeared on the balcony in St. Peter's Square, talked about peace, peace, peace as his mantra. He's interested in peace, in unity, which he thinks is desperately needed amongst a divided humanity. And I think the simplicity of that message is cutting through to people. I think what's interesting is that Pope Leo hadn't had quite so much mainstream coverage in recent months. I think the papacy was slightly struggling to kind of raise its comments into that arena. But I think this has vastly changed that.
And you must be surprised, as an academic theologian, that theology has suddenly become centre stage in an international argument.
One of the things I remember saying last year when J.D. Vance had introduced this whole question about the order of loves and quoted Augustine, supposedly, was that he'd achieved more in that moment by getting the world to suddenly look up St. Augustine and check what he'd said about the order of who we should love than most theologians would achieve in a lifetime. So, you know, we can have a degree of envy in a sense that, you know, that this is the way in which theology breaks through into the mainstream. But we are in a moment when, you know, theology is becoming a mainstream currency of ideas again, and it's being co-opted. And I think Pope Leo, again this week, if you look at the strongest elements of his statements, he's saying, don't co-opt God for your cause.
Professor Anna Rowlands. One of London's oldest churches is the Temple Church. It's the spiritual home of the legal profession, and its history stretches back to the medieval Knights Templar and the Magna Carta. The master of the temple, the Reverend Robin Griffiths-Jones, has been in charge for 30 years and is due to retire this summer. One of his legacies will be the repair work he was keen to show me, underway on the intricately carved Norman West Door.
Built in 1163, a classic piece of round-topped architecture, Romanesque, gorgeous, with seven orders, carved orders of decoration. So the first impression is fabulous. But when you actually look at it, you see that half of it is a most dreadful wreck. I mean, look.
They've actually almost worn away altogether. It's flat.
Within the last 10 years, it has become clear that all of the good, crisp, lovely stone is 12th century, and all of the rotten and decayed stone is from 1840. And absolutely nobody cares about a bad 19th century restoration.
So you can get your restorers onto those bad restorations?
We certainly can. And because there is so much of the 12th century stone left, our wonderful master carver, Nina Bilby, has everything she needs to go on to recover the original pattern and the legibility and the decoration.
This archway, when do you think it'll be back to its former glory?
If you come to a carol service this Christmas, OK, give it an extra month or two, but in principle it will be done. Hefo, let's push the door open.
Right.
And you will see why the Templars bothered to create such a fabulous archway outside. You can see this end of the church is round. It's a perfect circle. Why? Because the Templars' job was protecting pilgrims going to the Holy Land in the Middle Ages. The destination of every pilgrim was, of course, Jerusalem, centre of the world. And within Jerusalem, the most sacred place of all was the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the burial place of Christ. And the Holy Sepulchre is round. And it has, just as we have here, you see, a giant colonnade and a tall inner drum and a walkway round for pilgrims. The interior diameter is exactly half the diameter of the sepulchre in Jerusalem. To the medieval mind, you are now in Jerusalem. You're at the centre of the world.
And just explain to me the connection between the Knights Templar and the temple in Jerusalem.
Within a few years of their foundation, Jerusalem being at this stage, rather briefly, in Christian hands, the King of Jerusalem gave them the Aqsar Mosque on the Temple Mount.
And, of course, that became a very disputed area.
Didn't it? And still, of course,
still is,
of course.
Still is. And you yourself have been written about in fiction.
Yes, I must admit, I was momentarily surprised to find in 2003 that the Temple Church features in the Da Vinci Code, and worse still, I am in the Da Vinci Code. The master of the temple is described as being famous for having a perfectly foul temper. It is, after all, just possible that Dan Brown came in one day, unbeknown to me, and asked what I thought was a pretty stupid question about the Holy Grail, and I might have been slightly brisk. Well, he has his revenge. I mean, I loved it. It was really good. We had hundreds of people in church every day.
Because the Da Vinci Code is about the Knights Templar and about all that history.
And I was giving three talks a week about Jesus, Mary Magdalene, the Templar. I mean, it was to have so many people interested and engaged.
So it certainly hasn't done the church any harm.
No, of course it hasn't.
To have a bit of a myth around
it. No, of course it hasn't. No, it was a joy, actually, to have all sorts of interested people.
Now, behind us here is a magnificent organ.
It's a magnificent organ. It is actually second-hand. After the war, the organ had been destroyed. After the war, there were no organs for sale in London. It was hopeless, and there was no money. It was all hopeless. But our then organist, George Thorburn Ball, was the most famous organist in Britain. Before the war, he had played every organ. And on a June afternoon in 1950, he met Lord Glentanner of Glentanner Castle in Scotland on Cambridge Station. And he says, "Good afternoon, my lord. How is the organ in the ballroom at Glentanner?" To which his lordship replies, "Very disappointing. No one plays it anymore. Do you know someone who would like it?" He gave it to us. Fabulous, huge Harrison and Harrison 1920s, and if any of your listeners come in, it has this, it fills the place with sound. For what it's worth, here's another serendipity. Every 50 years or so, you have to give an organ an enormous MOT. Anyway, we did this 15 years ago, and because the church belongs to the Crown, we invited to the rededication Her Late Majesty. Before the service, the organist hit all 60 stops out. You have no idea, the whole building was shaking at the noise. And Her Majesty was standing outside with the Duke of Edinburgh, outside the big West Door. Where we have just been. And she says quietly, behind this racket, "How nice," she says, "to hear the Glentanner organ again." Ma'am? "Oh, yes," she says, "Glentanner is only 15 miles from Balmoral. I used to dance there when I was a gal." Oh, ma'am, welcome
great
back.
Story. The Reverend Robin Griffiths-Jones, a lovely tale there about the late Queen. And to commemorate what would have been her 100th birthday, a special documentary will be airing on BBC One at 9 o'clock this evening called Queen Elizabeth II, Her Story, Our Century. Buddhism, with its tradition of meditation and compassion, is not a religion you might associate with violence. However, from Rohingya expulsions by Buddhist mobs in Myanmar to Sri Lankan riots fueled by Buddhist militants, religious nationalism can turn monks into political players. Sonia Folero joins us now. She's investigated this phenomenon for a book called The Robe and the Sword, How Buddhist Extremism is Shaping Modern Asia. Good morning, Sonia. Tell me, has Buddhism changed, or do we in the West just have the wrong view of it?
Morning, Emily. Well, I would have to say that we in the West have a wrong view of it. And that has really been inspired by the global wellness economy, which is now worth over $1 trillion, and is based on the idea that Buddhism is about mindfulness and it's about meditation. And really what this industry does is glide over the fact that Buddhism is a religion like any other, whose followers are people like any other, and that like any other religion, it has a history that is deeply entwined with politics.
So does our view of it then come, say, from the Dalai Lama, who, of course, spread Buddhism and it became incredibly fashionable, didn't it?
Yes, it did. You know, we all remember the Dalai Lama being seated with Richard Gere. And of course, we've seen the films that have been inspired by our idea of Buddhism. It has to be said that the Dalai Lama has been the most exceptional face of Buddhism. You know, he had to flee Tibet in the 1950s after the Chinese violently occupied his country. And he set up a government in exile in Dharamsala in Northern India. He had the opportunity then to take a very aggressive approach towards what had happened towards his country. I mean, the Chinese killed so many Buddhist monks, but he chose to take a very Gandhian approach to this struggle. And that attitude has also played a role in how we view Buddhists.
It's interesting, isn't it? Now, and what have you found? I mean, you were travelling across Asia. What did you learn about the monks, many of whom you met, about the way they have taken a very different path?
Yes, I think one of the most disturbing revelations about what's happening in contemporary Buddhism in countries like Sri Lanka and Myanmar is that militant monks, these are people who are claiming erroneously, by the way, that their religion is under threat and that people must rise up against them and do whatever they can to protect Buddhism. They are gaining in popularity. Quite in the same way that populist movements elsewhere in the world are becoming entrenched, and they are.
I just wondered how they justify that sense of threat and taking such a different path.
Well, I think one way that they do that is, again, as I said, claiming that Buddhism is under threat. But the way they get their strength and their power is from politicians. Populist leaders in these countries are taking advantage of the fact that monks have a huge platform. And by working together, both these groups of people are making sure that their agenda takes them where they want to be.
So have you found then this idea of sort of non-materialism and breaking all your desires and all the things we tend to think about Buddhism just isn't there when you've been to these countries?
You know, sometimes I've been to temples where I've seen monks who are supposedly, they're supposed to be reading the scriptures or talking to people who've come to pray. And I've seen them actually just staring at their cell phones, going through Instagram reels or watching TikTok. And I do have sympathy, Emily, because we live in this modern world and monks are just regular people. And then they are also under enormous pressure. There is, I think, this desire to understand how can you be, you know, pure and spiritual and godly in a world that is increasingly modern, technological and chaotic. So they are facing the same struggle as clergy in other religions, for sure.
Right. And briefly, your book, which is quite critical, really, of this movement. Your book has faced criticism, hasn't it?
My book has got a wonderful response in places where, you know, Buddhist monks are not committing deadly crimes. So in the UK, the US, and places like India, for example. In places like Sri Lanka, Emily, there have been reports in the newspapers condemning me, claiming falsely that I've been sent by some government to undermine a Sinhala nationalism.
Okay.
People are sensitive.
Well, thank you very much. Fascinating. Sonia Falero. The time is just after 7:30. You're listening to Sunday. Still to come in the programme, we'll be getting an update on the Middle East, as well as hearing the views of Christians in the Gulf and the challenges of the aid effort in Lebanon. On this programme, we like to break down religious stereotypes. So this week, we've the story of the writer and performer Amina Alia Beg. She runs a company called Ajib Studios. Ajib means either strange or wonderful in Urdu and in Arabic. And she's holding workshops across the UK to break down taboos and persuade Muslim women over the age of 45 to try out being a DJ.
I wanted to launch these workshops. I wanted to teach older women of colour who are 45 and above. So, yeah, they wouldn't have to break the bank when it came to wedding season, because I feel like, especially in the South Asian community, we love to, you know, throw a party. It's sort of never ending. But I feel like when it comes to the finance, it's not so good.
So seriously, you're training them to be a professional DJ?
Yeah, basically, it's a crash course. I'll be teaching around the country to different community centres and theatres, inviting women to learn the basics of mixing.
What kind of music are you teaching them to play?
It'll be a mix of, yeah, South Asian, Arab. The DJ workshops are outreach from my play that I'm touring around the UK called My Mum Told Me Not to Marry an Atheist. And I play a radio presenter and a grandmother who's also a DJ. Essentially, it's about her relationship with her granddaughter, Kamal. And it's about love, marriage and intergenerational troublemakers. And essentially, I'm trying to, yeah, as outreach, teach women of colour how to DJ and then they can host their own events.
What is the skill that they're learning then?
Bringing in how to mix with two tracks together and how to understand all the different functions, because I know it can be quite overwhelming, all the different buttons. So it's just trying to simplify just sort of the basics of how to mix two songs. And it'll be a mix of music from the 70s, 80s, like Pakistani disco, songs that they enjoy that they would hear at weddings or events.
Let's hear some of the kind of music that you will be helping them play. Music and Muslim culture don't always mix, do they? Women taking charge like this and being a DJ is not always approved of?
Growing up, I've always seen it in harmony, and I would always hear the Quran in the house or at the mosque, and I feel like the recitation feels quite poetic and musical to me. There's Islamic tradition to connect to the divine using rhythm and poetry, and I hear a lot of it during Ramadan. Music is a way to bring people closer to God and to reflect on their emotions.
So you haven't had any pushback from the community?
No, I think my dad is quite proud. Like, you would tell everyone, like, if it's a family gathering or to a random stranger, that my daughter's a DJ, and I think he's secretly trying to manage. He's like, you need to play at more clubs, you need to be outreaching. Just been very supportive.
And do you think these women DJs, once they've learnt the craft,
yeah,
do you think they can go into clubs with men and alcohol and that kind of thing?
At the moment, the ladies I've worked with, like a charity called Let's Talk Rochdale, it's a women's organization founded by Hamer Haqqani MBE. They do ladies only events, and we've done like poetry workshops and creative showcases, like fashion shows, theater performances. The ladies really enjoy having that safe space of being able to party. And even women who are not women of color, even if it's clubs or events, they also feel unsafe when you're going to these events. So it's quite nice to have like a safe space for women. And I've seen it with the Let's Talk Rochdale ladies, like when we've done theater performances, like at Contact Theatre in June 2022. At first, everyone was really shy, but once you get them on stage, no one wants to go home. So there's something quite beautiful about that. People say there's a lack of talent when it comes to people of colour in the arts, but I think it's just a lack of opportunity. So I want to try and bridge that.
Is there a spiritual message behind your work? Does it fit with the Islamic faith?
I think it's always trying to seek justice and to try and spread positive messages and always trying to platform ourselves in a positive light. And to show nuance, like even the show, the grandmother being like a DJ and a radio presenter. And I think people have a reductionistic portrayal of Muslim women. So I want to sort of challenge that. DJing does that, comedy does that, all these art forms. You can push these narratives in a positive light.
Amina Alia Beg, and the deadline to apply for her DJ workshops is this Friday. The dialogue between the US and Iran is holding, but there's still no date set for face-to-face talks. Meanwhile, there have been reports of a tanker off the coast of Oman coming under fire from two Iranian gunboats and a container ship being hit by a projectile, which has led to Iran's military closing yet again the Strait of Hormuz. Well, for the latest there, we have our correspondent Nick Beek on the line from Jerusalem. Morning, Nick. Can you tell us, first of all, what is happening in the Strait?
Good morning, Emily. Well, it doesn't look like things are moving in the right direction in the Strait of Hormuz, and that is because it doesn't look like any vessels are moving in any meaningful direction at the moment. The Iranians are saying that they've closed the strait and it will remain shut so long as this US naval blockade remains in place. And by that, the Americans are saying they're preventing any Iranian-linked ship going to Iranian ports. So we're at this stalemate, really. And as you say, yesterday, tensions rose once again because we had reports that at least two ships were fired on. There was a report of a third incident where a projectile splashed in the water near another vessel. And in the first case, the skipper was adamant that it was two Iranian gunships that have opened fire. So, I mean, clearly that was not a good development.
And this blockage, as it were, how is that being dealt with, as far as you know, in these, what we hear are conversations between the two sides that are going on?
Yeah, well, it's hard, I think, to ascertain if any meaningful, quiet diplomatic progress is being made, because there is all this noise at the moment coming on social media, various maximalist pronouncements being fired out. The Iranians do say that they've received updated proposals from the US. We know that the Pakistani army chief has been in Tehran, Pakistan continuing to play this mediation role. And the best insight we've got so far in terms of what's happening has come from Iran's chief negotiator, and on the American side, from President Trump. First of all, Iran's chief negotiator, Mohammad Ghalibaf, he says the two countries remain far from a peace deal, but he did, Emily, note that there were just one or two issues on which the sides disagreed. Crucially, though, he didn't say what they were and he didn't explain their significance. President Trump, for his part, you know, he's remained supremely positive, in public at least, and he has said repeatedly an agreement will happen, and most recently he said that there have been very good conversations, as he put it.
That's very interesting. So there are some sticking points. Could this be about the nuclear issue, this Ukrainian dust that we're hearing about? This uranium dust.
Yes. No, absolutely. I think that is one of the two key things. First of all, the Strait of Hormuz, they need a short-term as well as medium and long-term solution on that. Countries in the Gulf saying completely unacceptable that Iran could charge tolls in the future for people to pass through. And yes, on the nuclear, that is really important. President Trump has claimed that Iran has basically agreed to everything he wants on that front. And that includes, he says, Iran handing over this 440 kilograms of enriched uranium. The Iranians have absolutely denied that. They said that is not going to happen. There's been no such conversation. And certainly, if Mr. Trump is right, that would be a huge achievement, because the previous deal with Iran that was signed back in 2015 that President Trump took the Americans out of, well, that took months of negotiation, some 18 months. You had lots and lots of scientists involved in the process. Mr. Trump wants his deal to be done in a matter of days.
Well, can we move now to Lebanon, where there's also a ceasefire, but we heard that a French soldier was killed there while taking part in a peacekeeping mission. Can you just update what's going on the ground there?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a ceasefire that's crucial to the prospects of a wider agreement and indeed peace at some point in the Middle East. The ceasefire that was agreed between Israel and Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed group, has given a bit of breathing room. That was certainly President Trump's phrase. And I think in that respect, it's right that it's sort of dialed down the tension somewhat. This ceasefire in Lebanon is holding. By its nature, like all ceasefires, it's fragile. As you say, yesterday, a French soldier was killed, part of the UN peacekeeping mission there. Hezbollah were blamed, President Macron of France among those saying the militant group were responsible. Hezbollah said they hadn't done it. And all the while, you've got lots of Lebanese heading back to their homes where that's possible. We know that in the past 6-7 weeks, more than 1 million people have been displaced. The health ministry in Lebanon saying that more than 1,300 people have been killed. So clearly that's still a really delicate situation.
OK, Nick Beek, thank you very much. And we'll be coming back to more on Lebanon a little bit later. With up to 5 million Christians living in the Gulf, all in Muslim countries, we wanted to find out how they were coping with the war and the fragile peace. We contacted Bishop Sean Semple, who's the Anglican Bishop of Cyprus and the Gulf, and David Axtell, who chairs the Council of Bahrain Cathedral. I asked the bishop first to describe the reach of his diocese.
This is a diocese that stretches across half of the Middle East and incorporates 10 countries, 9 of which are Muslim majority, 8 of which are under Sharia law. And despite that, there is a flourishing Christian presence there. Approximately 4 to 5 million Christians are actually resident in the Gulf, and we as Anglicans have churches in all of those 10 countries.
And these Christians are people who've come to the Gulf states to work, or are they indigenous to the region?
No, there are some indigenous Christians known as Chaldean Christians in Iraq. But for the rest of the Gulf, the Christians are all expatriates, and they come from all over the world. The majority come from the Indian subcontinent, Africa, and Southeast Asia. And the majority of Christians in the Middle East are Roman Catholic, followed by Orthodox, and then Anglican and Protestant.
Right. Well, can I turn now to David Axtell, your chair of the Council of Bahrain Cathedral. Tell us a bit about your congregation and what it's been like coping with the war.
Interesting challenge. And I think, as Bishop Sean has expressed, we're almost a microcosm of the global Christian presence, with virtually all nationalities in one building, one roof.
Tell me what's been happening. You know, you've been able to hear the attacks going on around you. Bahrain's in a very vulnerable position.
Yeah, very much so. And I think perhaps because we're a small island, we feel as though we're seeing and hearing pretty much everything that happens. Anything from drones flying past, interceptions to impacts. I've been in meetings subsequently where, you know, a door slams and people jump because they think it's an explosion. I found myself the other day listening to my kettle whining, and I was looking out of the window to see if it was a drone coming past the window. We've had people that have actually seen the impacts and had their windows blown out, people who've lost possessions. And trying to cope with the different manners in which people have reacted is quite challenging. You know, for example, we had one member of the congregation who had debris fall in his garden, but he was pretty relaxed about it with his family, whereas somebody a couple of doors down the road was across the causeway into Saudi Arabia later that day.
Bishop, just give us a sense of proportion here. Has Bahrain been affected more than elsewhere in the Gulf?
Emily, 8 of the countries of our diocese are directly opposite Iran. And so when this war began, most of our diocese was the target of attacks. And during the Easter period, I visited the UAE. I traveled across the Arabian Peninsula, went to Bahrain and to Qatar. And I experienced firsthand how people are living with the threat of death on a daily basis.
In the early stages, we were described by one government agency as a first responder. We were trying to offer people shelter, whether it be at the church. Bishop Sean very kindly offered, he has a residence, with it being a cathedral, he offered us use of that to house people who needed to move out of their homes.
And did you find that because a lot of the people in your congregation are migrant workers, some of them may have left because of the war? Have they come back?
Well, again, there's a broad mix. I wouldn't say there's one single route, but we've had somebody in the hospitality sector, and they've been told that they might have to go to half pay or be sacked. They've got colleagues who they left during Ramadan, as a lot of places closed down for the fasting during Ramadan, and their employees have not been brought back. So they are stuck in their country of domicile with all their belongings here in Bahrain. It's quite distressing.
And have people still been actually coming to church while missiles are flying?
We closed in the early weeks. We did some online services. One of the first ones, we hosted it from the church, and we actually had a missile fly over the top and be detonated quite close. So we were quite glad that we hadn't opened it up to the wider congregation. But I would say actually our church has become stronger. Our church attendance has gone up, and I would feel as though we've got a much greater sense of purpose, of who we are and what we should be, not only for our congregation, but also the wider community.
And tell me, I'm very interested to know how you think this is going to play out. How do you see things going?
No one can entirely predict whether things are going to escalate again or not. For a lot of people, their sense of the future has changed. Their sense of security in their country is now different to what it previously was. There are very difficult decisions to be made here.
I think to echo what Bishop Shaun has said, I mean, I've been in Bahrain for 30 years and very much see that as my home. And I've experienced in the last few weeks people who want to leave but can't, people who have had to leave but preferred it to stay. There's a real mix, but it's that, as Bishop Shaun has said, there's a real uncertainty. So I think as a church, you know, we need to remain agile and adaptable and gracious in all that we do.
David Axtell in Bahrain and Bishop Shaun Semple. Well, turning back now to Lebanon, where a 10-day ceasefire began on Thursday, intended to give space to negotiate an end to 6 weeks of war between Israel and the Iran-backed group Hezbollah. As we've heard, a French soldier was killed there and three others wounded yesterday in an ambush on UN peacekeepers, apparently carried out by Hezbollah. We've also seen dramatic images of the impact of the Israeli bombing of villages in southern Lebanon, with over a million displaced, creating a humanitarian crisis. A crisis which the CEO and founder of the Sikh charity Khalsa Aid International, Ravi Singh, is trying to do his bit to alleviate. And he joins us now. You're back in the UK. Tell us, Ravi, what was it like there?
Hi, good morning, Emily. Yeah, it's, how can I describe it? Imagine every school, every university, every public building filled with IDPs, internally displaced people and persons, and thousands of children. And not only that, the forced, I think the what we hear is people being displaced. What we don't talk about is the enforced displacement by the Israeli army, being told that within 10, 15 kilometers of the border, you have to clear up, get out, or you're the enemy. So people had no choice. It was very, very cramped. People are trying to work out where the clean water will be delivered, where the food will come from. And the one thing I really did notice on Easter Sunday, I was there myself, and we were doing food distribution anyway, but then some activities for the children. There's so many children, it breaks your heart. And as we were doing activities on Sunday, early afternoon or late morning, there was church bells. I mean, a lot of people who don't know the Middle East much, they don't understand, like the bishop just said, that, you know, so many churches in the region, especially Beirut, church bells were ringing. There was a street procession by the local Christian community. Kids were celebrating a magic show with us and happy and smiling. And next thing you know, the Israeli jets on warplanes on top, just leveling a built-up area within one or 2 kilometers away.
Does it feel as if a lot of the places that are being bombed it won't really be possible to come back to those places?
Well, South Lebanon is absolute different story. So I'm hearing from people who have gone back directly from those families and individuals working in the region that they've gone back with broken bridges, they've gone back to homes. They did not think they'll be raised as, so much destruction. I think thousands, maybe buildings since the beginning of March have been destroyed. Destruction is more heartbreaking. People who didn't expect that sort of like level of damage. And all we're hearing is the absolute heartbreak when village after village after village. It wasn't even on aerial bombardment. It was on the ground, like when we carry out a demolition of buildings. And that was what was happening to the villages. Absolute demolition. They've gone back to rubble. And now the ceasefire. What does ceasefire mean to them? The uncertainty of, we talk about political meaning to ceasefire. And what do they mean politically to the political world? What about the human cost? The people who have to return home now because they're fed up living in the buildings, they've gone back to rubble, and now they're uncertain, will the ceasefire be broken? When it ends, what will happen? Will they have to go back to north? So it's the uncertainty, anxiety in the people is real. The human cost of this conflict, which is now raging in the Middle East and threatening to expand, is absolute unacceptable. And we're accepting open war crimes, and we're accepting in the White House, the government's openly, the senators, the elected administrators saying, we will level this, we will produce the biggest bombs.
Well,
I mean,
the IDF have told the BBC that it operates in accordance with the law of armed conflict and doesn't allow the destruction of property unless there's an imperative militarily.
I think we all see that in Gaza.
Well, that's a lie. That's their view, and that will be disputed.
Absolutely disputed. We hear it from the ground, so I'll be visiting back again soon. And when, you know, if that was the case, Emily, why was an international journalist barred going into Gaza? I mean, to see the destruction. So we have to question that too then.
Right. OK, well, thank you very much, Ravi, for bringing that report. Ravi Singh there from Khalsa Aid International. Well, that's it for this week's Sunday. If you'd like to comment on today's programme, you can email us at sunday@bbc.co.uk or write to us at Dockhouse Media City, Salford, M50 2LH. And you can listen again or download the programme as a podcast from the BBC Sounds app. William Crawley will be here next weekend. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Emily Buchanan. Sunday was produced by Amanda Hancocks and Rosie Dawson. Now Ruby Palmer presents the Radio 4 appeal on behalf of Magic Bus UK.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Anybody any injuries?
No.
On a rough dirt pitch in Bombay Port Trust in India, a group of teenagers start football training with coach Nahida.
So we are going to learn how to defend in 2v2 today.
Okay.
Is everybody
These children, aged between 13 and 16, live in a nearby slum.
Yes.
Okay, let's go.
Twice a week, after school, they learn football and some valuable life skills. Because during each session, alongside practicing teamwork, communication and discipline, Nahida also talks to them about other parts of their lives. They'll discuss nutrition or the importance of health and hygiene. The aim of this coaching is simple. Give young people the stability of these sessions so they stay in school and finish their education. Coach Nahida understands the challenges these children face well. Now age 25, she was once a student on this same sports training programme. After moving to Mumbai at 13, she watched other children play football after school. At first, her father was unsure about her taking part. Some neighbours didn't like the fact that girls should be playing sport. But Magic Bus explained to him what the programme was all about, and he agreed Nahida could take part. For 3 years, Nahida came to training after class. She looked forward to these sessions. They kept her coming to school and helped her build her confidence. She passed all her school exams and decided to train as a sports coach. She was delighted to be offered a job with Magic Bus and now works in the same community where she grew up, passing on skills that helped her excel. With a good job, she earns enough to rent a home and support her family. Magic Bus has helped thousands of young people succeed through sport, but millions more remain trapped in hardship. It costs £30 to provide a year of sports sessions, and anything that you can give today will help another child or young person like Nahida to thrive. To donate, search online for BBC Radio 4 Appeal, or call 0800 404 8144. Or you can write a cheque to Magic Bus UK and send it to Free Post, BBC Radio 4 Appeal. That's the whole address. And importantly, please mark the back of the envelope, Magic Bus UK. Thank you.
Ruby Palmer. The number again, 0800 404 8144. Calls are free from landlines and mobiles. You can find details for giving online if you search for BBC Radio 4 Appeal. If you're a UK taxpayer and you want Magic Bus UK to collect gift aid on your donation, include an email or postal address so they can send you a gift aid declaration. The news is coming up after the weather forecast. Here's Elizabeth Rizzini.
Hello again. Thank you, Richard. Well, there's nothing too dramatic weather-wise in the forecast as we head through the next week. There's plenty of dry weather. There'll be some sunshine at times and the possibility of a few showers. But it's a lovely day for many of us today. Very pleasant in the best of the sunshine, which will tend to be best towards the southern half of the UK. High pressure has been building in from the southwest. It's set to dominate our weather. It will drift slowly further northwards. But it's dragged in some cooler air, so it's been a chilly start to the day with a touch of frost out there and still some early mist and fog patches. They should lift and clear fairly readily. They're mostly across Western Wales and southwest England. But it's a sunny start to the day for the vast majority of us. For Scotland and Northern Ireland, we'll gradually see clouds spread in those we head through the late morning into the afternoon, and that will limit the sunshine and the temperatures, so turning cloudier here across the northern half of the UK. For northwest Scotland, there could also be some showers on and off through the day. Northern Ireland, possibility of one or two isolated showers. Quite a bit of cloud, I'm afraid, but also some brighter spells here and there. Further south, England and Wales, the mist and fog will lift. There's a lot of sunshine today, some fair weather cloud, but still decently long spells of sunshine through the afternoon. And the small chance of a few isolated showers for the following places: Lincolnshire, North Midlands and East Anglia. But look, largely dry today, 12 to 15 degrees in the south and 10 to 13 Celsius further north. Tonight it's going to feel chilly again. There'll still be a feed of showers across northern and eastern areas of Scotland. Some low cloud towards eastern facing coast and across South Wales. The cloud will help to keep the temperatures a little milder, but where we have the clear skies, which is for most of us, lows of 1 to 4 degrees Celsius. So a localised frost into the start of next week again.
At 9 o'clock here on Radio 4, it's Broadcasting House. Paddy O'Connell, welcome back. What's on the programme?
Richard, hello and good morning to you. Well, there's fresh shipping chaos in the Strait of Hormuz amid talks. We report on Iran's Mosquito fleet of small raiding craft, and Lise Doucette will be live in Iran. At home, we've advice from teenagers on how to escape screen addiction. Get out there and do things, says our first youth panel. It's hot in the kitchen for Keir Starmer. We'll talk about that. And Prue Leith, who knows a lot about kitchens, we'll talk about comfort food to relieve listening to the news. Joining our press panel with political Prince Matthew D'Ancona and Richard Quest, star of CNN.
BBC News at 8 o'clock on Sunday, the 19th of April. Good morning, this is Charles Carroll. Iran says some progress has been made in talks with the United States to end the war, but warned both sides were still far from any agreement. One of Sir Keir Starmer's senior cabinet colleagues has insisted the Prime Minister would have blocked Lord Mandelson's appointment as US ambassador if he'd known about the latter's failure to pass security vetting. And a new charity in honour of Queen Elizabeth II will focus on bringing communities together. Iran's parliamentary speaker says there's been progress in peace negotiations with the United States, but gaps remain. Mohammad Baghir Ghalibaf gave the update in a televised address last night. President Trump has told Iran it cannot use the Strait of Hormuz to blackmail the United States after Tehran closed the waterway again yesterday. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is reporting from Tehran on condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service. These restrictions apply to all international media organizations operating in Iran.
The message from Mohammed Baghir Ghalibaf was clear. The Strait of Hormuz was under Iran's control. To prove his point, he spoke of an incident where Iranian forces had, in his words, firmly confronted a US minesweeper. It happened when he was in Islamabad last weekend for high-level talks with US officials. He had warned them that if the US ship moved from its position, it would be fired on. He said the US communicated that to its minesweeper within 15 minutes. Mr. Ghalibaf called the US naval blockade on Iran's ports a reckless and ignorant decision. President Trump has made it clear it won't be lifted until there's a deal between Tehran and Washington. Mr. Ghalibaf spoke of progress in the negotiations, but he said there were many gaps and some fundamental points, a starkly different assessment from Mr. Trump's upbeat account that a deal could be done in days.
The Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, says Sir Keir Starmer would not have appointed Lord Mandelson as ambassador to the United States if he had known about the issues with his security vetting. The row about the appointment process has already seen Sir Ollie Robbins lose his job as the most senior civil servant at the Foreign Office. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has written to the chair of the Cross-Party Foreign Affairs Committee. Its members will question Sir Ollie Robbins on Tuesday, perhaps to tee up a line of inquiry. In her letter, Ms. Cooper says she's extremely concerned that ministers hadn't been previously told about Lord Mandelson's security vetting. And in an interview with the Guardian newspaper, which broke the vetting story, the Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, has said he had no doubt that had the Prime Minister known that Peter Mandelson hadn't passed the vetting, he would never, ever have appointed him. But the announcement of Lord Mandelson's appointment was made before that security vetting had been completed. Writing in the Mail on Sunday, the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, accused Sir Keir of letting others take the fall while he clings to power. There doesn't seem at this stage to be a clamour from Labour MPs for the Prime Minister to follow Sir Ollie Robbins out the door. But the continuing controversy around the Mandelson appointment won't have improved his job security.
The Metropolitan Police is stepping up patrols in an area of North London where there have been a series of attacks on the Jewish community. Scotland Yard said counter-terrorism officers, as well as uniformed and plain-clothed police, would be on the streets to provide reassurance. Tom Simons reports.
The ramping up of policing includes extra armed response patrols, teams trained to intercept suspects using cars and motorbikes, as well as plainclothes officers specialising in counter-terrorism operations. Extra stop and search powers have been introduced across the London borough of Barnet to deter attacks and detect potential offenders. In the most recent incident on Friday evening, a man was seen setting light to a bag containing bottles of fluid outside the former head office of the educational charity Jewish Futures. Damage to the building was superficial, but it is being treated as an anti-Semitic hate crime. There have also been attempted arson attacks on a Persian language media organisation and a synagogue. In the most serious incident last month, ambulances belonging to a Jewish charity were set alight in Golders Green.
People are voting in Bulgaria's 8th parliamentary election in 5 years. The last coalition government collapsed in December under pressure from nationwide protests against its economic policies and its failure to tackle corruption. A new charity is being set up in honour of Queen Elizabeth II's lifelong commitment to public service. Its main aim will be to bring shared spaces in communities back into life. This week marks the centenary of Queen Elizabeth's birth. Here's our senior royal correspondent, Daniela Ralph.
The creation of the Queen Elizabeth Trust was inspired by the late Queen's own words when she said that everyone was our neighbour. The government is providing £40 million to establish the trust, which will have the King as its patron. The focus will be on restoring areas at the heart of communities, including underused buildings and green spaces. On Tuesday, the royal family will mark what would have been Queen Elizabeth II's 100th birthday. Buckingham Palace has also announced that the historian, Dr. Anna Kay, will write the Queen's official, authorised biography. Dr. Kay has been commissioned by the King and will be given access to the royal family and the late Queen's personal and official papers.
In football, the Manchester City manager Pep Guardiola says his side's bid to win the Premier League will be over if they fail to beat Arsenal this afternoon. Arsenal are chasing a first title in more than two decades, but have not won at Man City since January 2015. Our football correspondent John Murray reports.
Premier League matches don't come much bigger than this. With 5 weeks of the season to go, the top two lock horns in Manchester. The long-time leaders, Arsenal, have a six-point advantage over City, but have played one more match. So coming into today, both have their destiny in their own hands. A month ago, Manchester City beat Arsenal at Wembley in the League Cup final. Since then, they've not looked back, while Arsenal have faltered. And this could prove to be a pivotal day in their bid to win the league title for the first time for 22 years.
And a robot has beaten the new world record for a half marathon set last month by the Ugandan runner Jacob Kiplimo. It was among more than 100 humanoid robots which took part in a race in Beijing. The winning machine was built by the Chinese smartphone maker Honor. It shaved 7 minutes off the human record, completing the course in 50 minutes and 26 seconds. But at one point, it crashed into a railing and needed help to get up before finishing. Well, that's the news this morning. A look at the Sunday papers now. And Time for Straight Talking is the Sunday People's headline, as it leads on Iran's decision to close the Strait of Hormuz again because of a US blockade of its ports. The front of the Sunday Telegraph features a picture of a US Apache helicopter watching over tankers in the waterway. The paper quotes a Wall Street Journal report that the American military has drawn up plans to board and seize Iranian-linked ships in the coming days in an attempt to force a reopening of the strait. Kemi Badenoch's comments about the Prime Minister's handling of the Lord Mandelson vetting row make the front page of the Mail on Sunday. Starmer's not fit to run the country, is its headline. The Conservative leader writes that Sir Keir Starmer is taking the public for fools with his explanations about the vetting. A Labour source is quoted as saying no one is more lazy or unfit for office than Kemi Badenoch. An explosive debate is what the Observer is expecting when the Prime Minister appears before the Commons tomorrow to give his account of the vetting row. The paper says that he will be up against political rivals looking to make hay ahead of next month's elections. The Sunday Times editorial says that an unreserved apology is required from Sir Keir Starmer if he has any hope of drawing a line under this miserable affair. The Sun's leader suggests the vultures are circling around the PM already, a reference to the paper's story about what it calls a secret summit held by Angela Rayner and Andy Burnham on Friday night. The Sun says the bombshell revelation will fuel rumours that they're hatching a plot that could see Sir Keir face a leadership challenge within weeks. Allies of the pair insist that they are simply friends who talk regularly. The composer, Lord Lloyd Webber, has told the Sunday Times that he is a recovering alcoholic. He says that he decided he needed help 16 months ago and has been attending Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in the UK and in Switzerland. The peer is quoted as saying his family were in a desperate state, with his wife reportedly feeling that she couldn't go on. Going downhill, Liz, asks the Sunday Mirror, as it covers a trip by the former Prime Minister Liz Truss to the Swiss ski resort of Davos. She's described by the Mirror as shameless because the event is about building bridges with the EU, and Ms. Truss was an arch Brexiteer. Her spokesperson has declined to comment. The paper, though, suggests she is taking the piste. A look at Sunday's newspapers.
Charles Carroll. This is BBC Radio 4. The people who turned an old Cornish clay pit into an international tourist attraction are back together for the reunion this morning. Kirsty Walk celebrates the genesis of the Eden Project at 10 o'clock. Now, though, Sunday worship led by the Reverend Richard Carter, leader of the Nazareth community at St Martin in the Fields in London.
Good morning, I'm Richard Carter. I wonder if you have books that you always take with you. One of my favourite books that I've kept close to me for more than 35 years is by Brazilian Archbishop Dom Helder Câmara, called A Thousand Reasons for Living, first published in translation in 1981. Helder Câmara, once nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, believed that the poorest of our world should not have to wait until the afterlife to free themselves from oppression. Every morning it was Dom Helder's custom to rise at 2 a.m. in the darkness to listen to the voices so frequently drowned out by the daytime noise. Then it was that he felt he could listen to God, nature too, and the human heart. During these nights, Dom Helder Câmara wrote innumerable meditations. Each meditation is an encounter, an insight, a moment of revelation, like a wild flower that speaks to the human soul and the senses. The quality of these insights is that of one who is open and available to others and the world, who listens and sees, who is present, humble and attentive, who notices things that often go unnoticed. And what these meditations so often see is beauty and hope, even in the midst of struggle. Here are some of his words.
If you have 1,000 reasons for living, if everything speaks to you from the stone in the road to the star in the sky, if you understand the wind and listen to the silence, rejoice, because love walks with you. He is your brother. She is your sister.
I have lived on the edge of Trafalgar Square for more than 20 years, working in St Martin in the Fields and leading its Nazareth community. discovering each day in the people I meet and in the wonder of the world around me, reasons for living. Each of these reasons for living is like a door or a window that lets light in and seeks the miracle or wonder in our present life, wonders that can so easily go unrecognized or squeezed out. I too have the practice of waking early to spend time in silence, prayer, and contemplation, and write down my own diary of gratitude. In today's service, I would like to share some of the things that have opened my eyes to God's blessing. These reasons for living can be as simple as a smile, an encounter, an act of kindness, things you often take for granted. My hope is that you too will add your own reasons for living. Reasons for living 1, listening to the voice of others. A group of people, who are at present homeless, gather in an upper room, a room of creativity, art and light. This is our spiritual space where we meet each week. We welcome everyone coming through the door, the last as much as the first. We sit in a circle chatting, waiting for the latecomers to arrive, and I go in search of some of them. I know that each person in the room carries with them their own story, and many of their stories are heavy and painful, in fact not peaceful at all. And then we begin. Today I talk about the peace and the burden that we all carry. It's hard living on the streets. It's tensions, changing weather, lack of facilities, loss of dignity, an unknown future, mental health issues, fears, compulsions and stresses. This is the place, I tell them, where we can put our burdens down. It is a place where we can untangle the anxieties of our lives and untie the knots within. The light is flooding through the window, and I gently lead them into a meditation. I talk about breathing, the breath that fills us and expands, the breath that gives life. breathing in peace, holding peace within us, breathing out and sharing that peace with the world. Breathing in, holding, and breathing out. Then we keep a long silence, a silence that stills us and centers us. And then I ask, I wonder what brings you peace? And each person in the circle has space to answer.
The park. I just find a bench in the sunshine, a free bench on which no one else is sitting, a bench just for me. A bench that someone else put there for me just to sit in the sun. And I sit there, watching the day, and no one tells me to move. That's peace for me.
Walking. Just walking. Getting away from the noise and the crowdedness and walking so that all the thoughts move out of my head and stop bothering me.
I find peace in reading books. When you're reading books, you can't think of anything else. You just kind of enter into the story. Sometimes the story is so good, it's like I'm in the story, and I don't want it to end. And when I do finish the book, it's like that story has become a part of me. And if the story is happy, then I can share that happiness. And if it ends in sadness, I understand that too.
I find peace through singing.
She picks up a guitar.
I listen to the wind of my soul. Where I end up, well, I think only God really knows. I've sat upon the setting sun.
And me? I find peace by being in the presence of this group, with their hopes and their fears, and their abilities, despite all that faces them, to find peace. I find listening to them, really listening to the voice and experience of others, a reason for living. They are my teachers. And at the end of the group, there is such warmth and peace within us. And it is because we have really heard each other. Really heard. What greater gift to give each other than our attention and our listening?
Peace I give you, my peace I give you. Be not afraid, my peace.
Reasons for living too. A walk in the park. Living in the centre of a city, sometimes the noise, the traffic, the sirens, the buskers are all 24 hours. I don't have a garden, but I have a garden that belongs to everyone. I have St. James's Park, where I am now, and the London parks to walk through. They are a sanctuary for me and for many others. And who could want a better garden? St. James's Park with its lake, fountain, trees and birds. It's birdsong. Listen. This is the park where I come to pray each week, early in the morning, come what may, in wind and rain, cloud and sunshine. There is a place here among the London plane trees and copper beeches where I watch the seasons change and feel the rhythm of the natural world. Each season is beautiful to me. Winter trees in the winter light with their silhouettes and latticework of branches against an icy sky. And now when spring comes, the squirrels are trapezing through the branches looking for food. And we've just seen the daffodils out in force, with hundreds of yellow trumpets of hope. And the knots of the tree's new leaves have begun to unclench and open in newborn greens. And of course, the blossom. Blackthorn first, then Japanese cherry and sweet cherry and pink crabapple, and later the whitebeam and hawthorn will froth with flowers to celebrate the sun. Soon it will be summer, with its deck chairs and bandstands. After a long day, I will come here to sit in the evening light and read. And the leaves will be so thick you will almost not be able to make out the lake. And the park will be filled with picnickers and people pulling off shirts to feel the warmth of the sun. Couples will be lying in knots kissing, and toddlers will be tottering down paths with proud parents waiting to gather them and swing them in the air as they giggle and cry. And I will ride up the Mall on the way to the proms with the dust and pollen in my eyes from the plane trees. Then autumn will come, as the summer always seems to part too quickly. This is the time of such wonderful colour. Reds and golds, umbers, yellows and browns. This is the time to notice the shape of leaves. The park, a reason for living. When John Nash redesigned St. James's Park with its natural curves and vistas, he would never see the park fully grown as we now enjoy it. These parks are our free national gardens for everyone. They are our inheritance. I wonder what we will leave behind for future generations. Reason for Living 3. The Example of Trees. I'm still in the park, and the trees themselves are a reason for living.
You ancient trees that look down on the madness of our world. You that were here long before I was born. And you that will be here long after I am gone, I hope. Teach me your secret. Open to the rhythms of God. The roots of the tree intertwining. The strength of these limbs, the thinner roots, like fingers rising from the earth to hold and nourish. Beneath the earth, thousands of roots reach down and out, in conversation with other trees and with the soil to anchor and to whisper to one another their message of life. I love the trunk of a tree growing upwards, its powerful stability, its bark, its colour, its knots and scars, its strength and yet its movement. Then the limbs and branches, bending and forking and dividing, each branch tapering, thinning, twisting, turning and shooting into an intricate latticework of smaller branches, curves and crooks, elbows, arches and tangles. I love looking up and seeing the light through the branches of a tree framing the sky in thousands of shapes, bends, twists and openings. The shards of light like the stained glass fragments of a cathedral window, a kaleidoscopic pattern of light and colour. Glory be to God for dappled things. The trees speak. Give back time to the earth. Give back space to God. See the life of God in all things. Be attentive to the rhythms of creation, lest you miss the true miracles of God unfolding.
Reasons for Living 4. Walking. We don't just make relationships with other people. We also make relationships through the paths we take, the trees we meet, the water, the earth, the squirrels, the birds, the hills, the valleys we walk, and through the stiles we climb over and the fields we cross, the stories we encounter. Each encounter on the journey can be an epiphany. By walking, we walk with and alongside the natural world, and we begin to realize that nature is not something out there and alien, but a relationship, a connection, on which all our life and future depends. By walking, we begin to see that the places we walk have souls too. And in order to discover that soul, we must come alongside and walk with, through and in. The church itself begins to exist when we leave our territories behind and enter into shared spaces, spaces of learning and listening, sacred spaces. As I walk with nature, I learn to name, honour, see, sense, and relate to the world in which we live. Not because I want to master or control it, but because I'm discovering its living soul, its wonder. And the more we walk, the more we are filled with awe and love for the world, as well as pain for all that is hurting in creation. As Gerard Hughes used to say, solvitur ambulando, the solution lies in the walking. I'm aware of how that word to walk is a metaphor for all movement, the movement of one's imagination and soul through a landscape. So I hope and pray that if you have mobility difficulties, you can replace this verb to walk and celebrate the journey of your own spirit through God's creation.
We shall walk through the valley in peace. We shall walk through the valley in peace.
Reason 5. Wounds that become signs of resurrection.
Our gospel is taken from John chapter 20, verses 24 to the end. One of the 12, Thomas, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands, and put my finger in the mark of the nails, and my hand in his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were again in the house, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Do not doubt, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through believing, you may have life in his name.
Christ's wounds are the signs of the pain and violence that is still being inflicted on our world, for we are still crucifying one another with bombs, bullets, drones, and the misuse of wealth and power. The more attentive we grow to the world, the more attentive we become to the suffering of our neighbour. But in our gospel, wounds can also become the signs of resurrection. This is our resurrection hope. Love feels the pain of the world, and it is often in the pain of abandonment and doubt that we long most for the one who can redeem our world and set us free. Sometimes it would be easy to despair, to be so overwhelmed by the cruelty of our world, to see only the fear, the fault, the failure, the cross, so that we fail to see the resurrection. The risen Christ reveals to us a different truth. He wanted to show us that he is risen. He saw the seed which fell upon the ground and died, becoming a new life. He saw the good in us, our potential to become. He saw all creation and it was good. He saw people not defined by sin, but set free by forgiveness and grace. See his heart for Peter, for the tax collector, for the leper, for the woman taken in adultery, for the paralyzed man lowered through the roof, for Zacchaeus, for the man blind since birth, for the thief on the cross, for Mary in the garden. He saw humanity released by God's love from the burden of fault or sin they carried. He saw their potential to put their burdens down and to walk in his light. He calls us all out of the tomb. He unbinds us and lets us go free. He sends us out as the bearers of his risen life. He sows the seed of new life in us. He called us to be the springtime, to bear fruit that will last. Charles de Foucault used to say on meeting a follower of Jesus Christ, you should say, "If that is what the servants are like, how I long to meet their master." Reason for Living 6. Being Set Free. Jesus says at the grave of Lazarus, "Unbind him and let him go free." To help others unbind, we need to unbind ourselves. True freedom is a reason for living.
Free like the blackbird, who will not stop singing in spring.
Free as a river is free that cannot stop flowing. And free as the wind is free, as it gusts and blows where it wills.
Free as the clouds are free, for they have the whole of the sky on which to sail, so that even the darkest rain clouds never stay forever. Free as the sunlight is free, as it pierces the canopy of leaves and fills this garden with dappled light.
Free as the breath within me is free, as I breathe in and then out into the world my own breath of life.
Free as my heart is free, which cannot be imprisoned, whatever the agendas, violence or coercion we see oppressing the world.
Free as real love is free, which cannot be overcome by loss or guilt or even death.
Free as Jesus is free, as he opens the tomb of human cruelty and walks out into the morning, going before us and meeting us by the sea for breakfast.
Free as human beings are free, when we recognize our fear and stop seizing, attacking, blaming, grasping, manipulating, invading, killing, and learn the wonder of loving as Jesus has loved us.
In the words of Desmond Tutu, "Goodness is stronger than evil. Love is stronger than hate. Light is stronger than darkness. Victory is ours through him who loves us."
Reason for Living 7. Praying. Let us pray.
Teach me, my God and King, in all things thee to see, and what I do in anything, to do it as for thee.
Thanks be to thee, my Lord Jesus Christ, for all the benefits thou hast won for me, for all the pains and insults thou hast borne for me. O most merciful Redeemer, friend and brother, may I know thee more clearly, love thee more dearly, and follow thee more nearly, for ever and ever.
Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there's hatred, let me sow love. Where there's injury, pardon. Where there's despair in life, hope. For it is in giving that we receive. It is in pardoning that we are pardoned. And it is in dying that we are born to eternal life.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, for ever and ever. Amen. And the blessing of God Almighty, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, be with all those you love and all those you will meet this day and forever. Amen.
Sunday worship was led by the Reverend Richard Carter, leader of the Nazareth community at St. Martin-in-the-Fields. The producer was Andrew Ayres. You'll find the script of that programme and details of the music played on the Sunday worship website. It was an innocent question from his 8-year-old son that prompted Roger Hargreaves to draw the first of his Mr. Men in 1971. And in a moment, Adam Hargreaves is on Witness History. That's after a look ahead to new drama this afternoon.
We can't just come clean, can we?
But the paperwork. Think of the paperwork.
Brand new drama starring Toby Jones,
based on Kate Atkinson's best-selling thriller.
7 words scrawled in terrible handwriting. You will pay for what you did.
Wartime espionage with post-war repercussions.
Do you think I should be worried?
Well, that depends what you did.
She's betrayed us.
You haven't betrayed us, have you?
I'll kill you! I'll kill you!
Transcription starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds this afternoon at 3.
Now on Radio 4, history told by people who were there. It's Witness History with Megan Jones.
I'm taking you back to the 1970s, to the birth of a beloved series of children's books full of bright, bold characters with names like Mr. Tickle, Mr. Happy and Mr. Bump. Mr. Men and later Little Miss were created by Roger Hargreaves and went on to become a global success. I've been to meet Roger St. Adam, whose curiosity inspired the very first character.
I think my dad's main thought and ambition was just to make young children giggle. They're all about humour and turning the kind of real world upside down.
It's 1971 and we're in Surrey. During the week, you'll find Roger Hargreaves writing adverts for everything from chocolate to cars.
When I was young, he was working in London and commuting up to London, so I didn't see him in the week at all. I was in bed by the time he got home.
But his ambitions were bigger than advertising.
He was always having ideas, creative ideas, and he was ambitious creatively. I think his greatest ambition was to be a strip cartoonist. His great hero was Charles Schulz.
That's the creator of Peanuts with Charlie Brown and Snoopy. Today, Roger's at home and things are about to take a different turn, beginning with a simple question from his then 8-year-old son, Adam, at breakfast.
What does a tickle look like?
Now, have you ever thought about that before? What does a tickle look like? If you search the word online, you'll find loads of pictures of people smiling and laughing, or that typical image of a feather near someone's feet. The more you look into it as well, there are loads of different ways to say it around the world. So in French, you might say chatouiller. In Hindi, it's gugudi. Yang yang in Mandarin. Cosquillas in Spanish. Or dagdaga in Arabic. But whatever you call it and whether you like it or not, we all know that strange, funny feeling. For Roger, it was enough to spark an idea.
I think he suddenly realised that, yes, you could personify human traits, emotions, characteristics, and then turn them into a character.
He picks up one of his many pens and starts drawing.
My dad, I have to admit, worked pretty much on his own. He was not a great one for showing the family what he was doing as he created it. It was more a point of we'd see it after it was finished. He always used magic markers to colour in the picture, so there was always that sort of chemical smell that the pens gave off.
On the paper in front of him, an orange character starts to appear with a round body, long stretchy arms and a blue bowler hat. It's Mr. Tickle. All he needs now is a story.
They're short and quite simple stories. And my dad would design them quite specifically as short stories because he was, I think, fed up with reading the likes of Beatrix Potter and Thomas the Tank because they're quite long stories. There is a kind of a discovery side to it in terms of finding out what humans are. There's a certainly with some of them, a lesson to be learnt.
He puts together a rough version of the book.
So this is essentially a Mr. Mem book, drawn on card or very thick paper because pens he used at the time bled through. So he printed on card and he taped it up with a sort of gaffer tape on the spine. And this was the original story.
He takes his mock-up to publisher after publisher. None are interested. And it seems Mr. Tickle may never leave Roger's house. That is, until Roger goes for lunch with an old friend, Jack Thurman, a printer who had just set up a publishing company.
Jack said, well, if you write them all, then I'll publish them.
And he did. In August 1971, the first 6 titles came out. There was Mr. Tickle.
Tickles are small and round, and they have arms that stretch and stretch and stretch. Extraordinarily long arms.
Then came his friends. And to introduce them, I've asked for a little bit of help from my nieces and nephews.
Mr. Greedy liked to eat. In fact, Mr. Greedy loved to eat.
And the more he ate, the fatter he became.
Mr. Happy!
On the other side of the world, where the sun shines hotter than here, and where the trees are 100 feet tall, there's a country called Happyland.
Mr. Nosey
liked to know about everything that was going on. He was always poking his nose into other people's business.
Mr. Sneeze!
Every morning, Mr. Sneeze woke up, sneezed,
achoo.
Got up, sneezed,
achoo.
Got dressed, sneezed,
achoo.
Went downstairs, sneezed,
achoo.
Ate his breakfast, sneezed,
achoo.
And went to work, still sneezing.
Mr. Bum!
If there was something for Mr. Bump to bump into, he would bump into it all right.
Those first six were only the beginning.
It's wonderful to see the inside of somebody's imagination. I mean, that's really kind of what comes out of the Mr. Men books. It's my dad's, yeah, imagination in full flow.
As the books took off, Roger kept adding more characters, drawing them during his lunch breaks.
I've got a plaque on the wall which was given to my dad, and that was to commemorate 1 million books sold. It was a very fast success.
In 1974, the Mr. Men leapt from page to television, complete with their own catchy theme tune.
It's a genius bit of music making. It's so iconic, and so obviously the Mr. Men now, everybody recognises it.
It was narrated by star of Dad's Army, Arthur Lowe.
This story starts with Mr. Lazy being fast asleep in bed. In Sleepyland, they call that being slow asleep. He spends rather a lot of time in bed. It's his favourite place to be.
The BBC series then really escalated the success of it, and the merchandising agent was able to create an enormous amount of product.
There were toys, jigsaws, clothing.
There were Mr. Men mugs in the cupboard and all that sort of thing. He was terribly proud of all of that.
The success meant Roger could finally stop juggling the characters with his advertising job.
I think that was a lot of what drove his ambition to create something for himself, was that he was looking to not have to commute to London every morning.
By the late 1970s, the Mr. Men songs were released on BBC Records, composed by Joe Campbell.
Let's go to Mr. Land, the land of magic. Come on and sing.
Then the Mr. Men got some more friends.
My father did finally catch up with the female side of the population, and he created the Little Miss characters.
The first ones, released in 1981, included
Little Miss Naughty and Little Miss Bossy,
Little Miss Sunshine, Little Miss Trouble and Little Miss Helpful. But in 1988, everything changed.
The man who invented the Mr. Men has died. Roger Hargreaves drew the first blob-like Mr. Man 17 years ago. Since then,
Roger was 53. At the time, Adam was working in farming. But at just 25, he stepped in to run the family business.
It's a strange thing. At the time, I didn't think too hard about it. But looking back on it, I think it was strangely cathartic. Even though I was sitting at my dad's desk and in his office, it gave me something to concentrate on.
It took a little time before Adam began drawing, but in 2003, he released his first characters.
I created 3 Mr. Men and 3 Little Miss.
Today, the Mr. Men and Little Miss books have sold more than 120 million copies, been translated into over 15 languages, and there are now over 90 characters. So, does Adam have a favourite?
My favourite character is Mr. Silly. I think he really epitomises my dad's sense of humour. I always imagined that that was my dad's favourite character. And I also love the story. I think the story is genius. It's really funny.
55 years after Roger Hargreaves drew that first orange circle with long arms, the world he created is still expanding, with a new TV series and film coming out. The question is, what would he have thought of it all?
Oh, he'd be incredibly chuffed. I mean, really excited to have Mr. Men up on the big screen in the cinema. He would have been very, very happy to have seen that, and it's a terrible shame that he can't.
Witness History was presented by Megan Jones. For more memorable moments from history told by people who were there, search for Witness History on BBC Sounds. Now on Radio 4, Tweet of the Day. the explorer and filmmaker Roland Arneson is on a rocky shoreline surrounded by fulmars. The programme is produced by Sophie Anton.
Of all the seabirds I've encountered on my kayaking expeditions, it's the northern fulmar that has captured my heart. They don't draw attention to themselves, but are utterly beguiling with their effortless aeronautical abilities in even the wildest storms, their unexpectedly gentle clucking, and their curiosity when they circle me as I paddle my kayak alone in the vast sea. Here I am on the Isle of Mingalay, one of the most remote and spectacular islands of Scotland's Outer Hebrides.
We're sitting on the edge of a rocky chasm, a cliff above it, and about a dozen pairs of fulmars nesting on little grassy mounds. There are times when nothing's happening at all, then suddenly somebody starts chattering, then they all join in. And the fulmars love to fly. It's a beautiful thing to see as they swoop around in these endless circuit flights in front of the cliff or above the gully here. Masters of the air, they'll launch themselves from their nest. If a gust of wind catches them,